And good evening, everybody, and welcome to peoplesinternetradio.com. Wow, what a tune. As many of you know, I had sent that out, the YouTube link to everybody. That was Own Casey. And, you know, that's a powerful, powerful tune. And for some reason, it's not shown in my history. It should have done. But welcome, anyway, to peoplesinternetradio.com. I'm going to dig that song up for you on YouTube and give you the link again, folks, because what I'd like you to do, if you can, is to share that video with as many people as you can and get the song out. I think it's a great song. Own Casey. He just executed it beautifully. There we go. I got it now. Copy link address, and I'll just give it all to you into the chat box in case you haven't already got it. So there we go. So apparently, today is seemingly 28th of September, 2014, and 9:05 seemingly, depending on where you are. Tonight, of course, the quasi-contract. Demolished. Destroyed. Executed. If you'll excuse the pun. What the hell are quasi-contracts? What are implied contracts? And how does all this relate to you and water meters? Now, you see, water meters, I believe, we're kind of flogging a dead horse here in one sense, because I think really, you know, I think the water meters have been defeated effectively. People power is growing and getting stronger and stronger, and I can't see forced water meter installation continuing for much longer, because I think the politicos are noticing it's having a very strong unifying effect on the population. So what they'll probably do, this is my prediction for you folks, again, how accurate it is, who knows, but what they'll probably do is divert into something else. They say, yes, of course, it was a ridiculous idea to have water meters in the first place. That was the other guy's fault, not us. And they're going to maybe do what they did in Scotland, England, whatever, introduce a bedroom tax or something like that. Something where they don't actually have to invade you. Just announce, yes, we're taxing, or a back garden tax. If you have a back garden over 20 square meters, they're going to tax it. Luxury tax on your back garden. Something. I know some people are probably getting annoyed at me now saying, stop giving them ideas, Vin. But look, do they really need them? They seem to, come up with plenty of crazy ideas on their own. So what I'd suggest is learning about quasi-contracts, implied contracts, and being able to distinguish the two is a valuable life skill regardless, no matter what happens in relation to water meters or otherwise. So let me try to give you a taste as what, let's say, the Wikipedia version of, in fact, here is the Wikipedia link to quasi-contract. And this is important, folks, because effectively we are walking, talking, contracting machines. That's what being alive is all about. You know, you say hello, goodbye to somebody, you're contracting, you shake a hand, it's a form of contract. There's offer, acceptance, consideration, performance, capacity, all these other ideas. They're all intermingled and interlinked and interlocked and interlaced. It's all part of the whole deal, if you will. So according to Wikipedia, quasi-contract, and they have in brackets, or implied-in-law contract, or constructive contract. Now, to my mind, those brackets and what's in them doesn't really belong there, because quasi, implied, and constructive, they're all different. I mean, that's why they have different terms, right? So, okay, this is Wikipedia, I suppose, and it's attempting to kind of give a an overall general notion. So they're saying a quasi-contract is a fictional contract created by courts for equitable, not contractual purposes. And that sentence itself has I don't know how many contradictions. And you can probably see right there, it's a fictional contract created by the courts in an equitable manner, and it's non-contractual. Yeah, it's, you know, wow, okay. So, in other words, it's made up, no offer, acceptance, consideration, performance necessarily is required, and it's for the purposes of equity, which is quite humorous, because, of course, equity is supposed to mean fairness, equity, equality, equal to balanced. So what the hell is going on? Okay, well, We'll read on and we'll see if we can get a little bit more of a grasp here in Wikipedia. A quasi-contract is not an actual contract, but is a legal substitute formed, and here's my favourite word in this whole thing, which gives the whole game away, formed to impose equity. And they say between two parties, I would suggest that's onto, well, probably onto one party in Irish Water's case. The concept of a quasi-contract is that of a contract that should have been formed. I mean, it's like reading a comic book, this, folks. It's a comedy. This is like a blundering comedy of errors. Even though in actuality it was not, it is used when a court finds it appropriate. Notice, a court finds it appropriate, not you. No. This is when the court finds it appropriate to create an obligation upon a non-contracting party to avoid, and here was the funniest, I mean, I actually laughed out loud when I read this. You ready for this? To avoid injustice. That's right. That's what it says. To avoid injustice and to ensure fairness. It is invoked. It's an invocation to the gods of contract law, seemingly. It is invoked in circumstances of and is connected with the concept of restitution. I'm sorry, that I almost don't know where to begin with that entire paragraph, because, okay, let's try. So what they're effectively saying in that opening paragraph is, in a situation where they deem it appropriate that somebody or some inverted commas entity has done something to or for you that they perceive to be a benefit to you, regardless as to whether you perceive it to be a benefit or not, they are going to impose upon you the payment, and grant the right to collect that payment onto the other party, even though they forced a situation upon you against your wish. I mean, did I miss anything there, folks? I mean, it's not called Wackipedia for no reason as a nickname, but this concept of quasi-contract, folks, quite frankly, it's laughable. Now, why the hell am I talking about this in relation to Irish Water? Well, here's why. Irish Water basically made a statement there a while back, I believe it's attributed to them anyway, that if people didn't pay up, they would sue in a court under, you know, normal jurisdiction for breach of contract in the usual manner, as they say, you know, normal breach of contract. But of course, that's impossible. The only way they could take you to court and even attempt to sue you, if, you know, that's what happens, is by means of either a quasi-contract or a perhaps implied-in-law contract, completely different concept, although it has elements of the other, or a constructive contract. So maybe we should deal with implied-in-law contract or implied contract and constructive contract. Let's have a little chinwag about that. So, for example, an implied contract would be somewhere along the lines of, let's say you keel over at the side of the road and you're unconscious, and somebody with medical capability and as a profession, you know, comes along and treats you and, you know, gets you back on your feet, and maybe they have to use some of their material. So they will feel that they have the right to charge you for that, especially if you sit up and you smile at them and you say, thank you very much, you helped me, etc., etc. That would be an implied contract. Because it's implied in law, if you will, in law, that whole idea, but sit that to one side for a second. It's implied, if you will, that you, even though you were unconscious, you found it beneficial. I mean, you're alive again, right? You found it beneficial when whomever came along revived you. And if they, well, you know, consumed some medical equipment or, you know, medicinal ointments, whatever, you know, it's appropriate, says the court system, that's the court system, that you reciprocate. That's implied. Now, many people might think, well, that's true, maybe, to some degree, but I could also just decide to say, well, I didn't ask you to do anything for me, and just walk away. Which is kind of under natural law, if you will. That's kind of law of necessity, perhaps. You could decide, maybe you were trying to kill yourself. Maybe you were happy you weren't here anymore. I don't know. But maybe we could, I'm sure we could construe or construct some idea or notion around that idea. Now, a constructive contract, again, different again. A constructive contract would be along the lines of elements of implied, elements of quasi, I suppose. But you see, let's say after the doctor treated you and you didn't thank him and then you didn't say, that's great, I feel much better. But if you do, on top of implying that you therefore are willing to reciprocate, constructive would be, say, he didn't revive you. You just remained in a comatose state, but he got you to the hospital and they got you onto life support. So you're still alive, but technically, you know, your body is still alive maybe. And they say, well, there's no brainstem activity or whatever. And the doctor is going to put in a bill, perhaps against your estate. That would have elements of that. But taking a step back to the beginning there, quasi-contract in relation to Irish Water, I can't see how they'd get anywhere with that. Implied and constructive, perhaps. Now, why is that? Well, let's say you go out, somebody shows up and fits a water meter or whatever to your property, your dwelling, and sends you a bill. Believe it or not, the system, if you will say, well, that's fine. You say, but I didn't ask for it. I didn't order it. They say, no, that's okay, but he showed up, he fitted, and he's entitled to a fair price for his work. That is the way the system looks upon things like that. It happened a long time ago, and I don't know if it happens so much anymore, but it did happen for a time. For example, people were finding they would leave their home in the morning and come back in the evening to find their driveway had been dug up and tarmacked, even though they didn't ask anybody to do it. And they'd be handed a bill, and they'd object to the bill, perhaps, and they'd try to take whomever to an equitable court seeking remedy, only to be told, yep, you have to pay the bill. You don't have to pay, maybe they were looking for 10 grand for 5 grand's worth of work. You know, the normal price for that in the industry standard price is 5 grand. So you do owe them 5 grand, and because you didn't actually ask them to do it, they've been telling people, well, we'll give you a year to pay it. That has actually happened. It was happening here in Ireland for quite some time. It was happening in England too, I think. And there was a big to-do about it on the likes of the Joe Duffy radio show and whatnot. And people were shocked and stunned when they were saying, but Joe, I never asked them to come and fit or to re-tarmac my driveway. I never asked for it. And yet people felt they were getting cleaned out. Well, they were getting cleaned out in courts. But why? Well, you see, even though a quasi-contract is no contract at all, when you go to a court, here's the thing, folks. Here's the kicker, as they say. You have to contract with the court. And once you contract with the court, they are going to not just assume, but presume you have handed the ability to make the decision over to them. That is the presumption. You no longer are making a determination about this. You've handed that ability to them. You have, if you will, given your sovereign license to them to now make determinations about your life on your behalf. That's effectively what you're doing when you bring an issue into their courts. I mean, who doesn't think that? And because you've done it that way, they get to decide, well, we're all about equity in here. Now, they'll talk about equity and maybe in a different manner to the way you might talk about equity and what you might believe equity to be. But he's going to sit there and go, well, I got a bill on one side, and we got a barrister solicitor maybe, you know, and well, everybody needs to get paid for their time here today. So, yep, I'm going to make a determination. No, you don't have to pay the 5,000 or the 10,000. We'll leave it at 5,000, and you've 12 months to pay him. That's reasonable. And, I mean, after all, you have a brand new driveway. You didn't ask for it, but that's okay. And that's actually, I mean, by all means, don't take my word for it, folks. Go look them up. Those cases are all over the papers in Ireland and England, as far as I know. They were all over the place. Don't think it happens so much anymore, because I think some people started to get a little bit sharper and they started to bring in more elements into these court cases. And I don't think they're that inclined to hear cases like this anymore. And they're, you know, because they basically bring, they make the whole system look bad, you see. They don't want the whole system to look bad. So they try to avoid this as often as possible. Now, with Irish Water, if you bring them in, you effectively you have to do the same thing. You have to give to the court your sovereign blessing license, if you will, to make a determination on your behalf. They do too. So both parties, if you will, have to hand that over to the court. It's only an idea or a notion, folks, but this is what we're doing here. Now, what's the remedy to all this, I suppose? What's the solution? Well, it's varied, I suppose. I'd like to bring this up. I see there's so many people out there just doing a version or a form of the return to sender process, which, you know, we all know how long we've talked about that on here. And again, much appreciation to Mr. T for all his fantastic information that he shared with us down through the years and provided us with. But yes, I know you're going to say, but people are changing it, Finn. People are altering it. And I go, I know. And, you know, people say, well, that's not right, Finn, and this is not right. And I see a lot. And I go, hey, who are we to decide what is or what is not right in relation to that? If other people come across the information and they change it and share it and it spreads, that's not down to us. I mean, you know, that's not down to us. That's not down to Mr. T. As far as we're concerned, Mr. T gave us accurate information and we've used it to great effect, many of us. And, you know, I'm sure we've all appreciated it. I know I have. But if other people change it, what can you do, folks? People change shit all the time. That's what people do, unfortunately. That said, it's really a numbers game. I was listening to the OIM guys there beforehand, and look, Irish Water and the postal system are getting buried in return to senders of some form or another. And some people, I think, was it the Dublin Says No crowd had a competition to see who could come up with the most entertaining version. And some of them were, I have to admit, they were quite amusing. I saw one guy had a little cutout of Elvis holding a microphone as if he was singing Return to Sender with the little music notes in the air. You know, you gotta smile when you see that, you know, you gotta smile. So, you know, would we feel it was accurate? Perhaps not. Is it funny? Hell yeah. And at the end of the day, it's a numbers game. They're being buried in Return to Senders. And I think, it's telling when you see, people who are from the political arena come out and say, oh, don't return to the sender. No. You know, don't fill it out though. Just, bin it. They're telling people to bin it. And I thought, wait a minute. Why would they be telling people to bin it? If you bin it and you don't return it to sender, you're facilitating the creation, perhaps, of a quasi or implied or constructive contract. Pardon me. Whereas, if you return it to sender, you're destroying that element. That's the whole point of a return to sender. You're preempting somebody hauling you into a courtroom and claiming you have formed with them some form of a constructive contract, an implied contract, or indeed at a stretch, even a quasi-contract. By returning it to sender, you're preempting that, because if you return it to sender, and if they still manage to pull you into a courtroom in some way, shape, or form, you get to stand up and say, I returned that offer. I declined the offer. I returned it to sender. Again, I'm not recommending you should do that. You know how I feel about going in there. But I'm saying, you know, think about it in that way, that you could do that, you see. Whereas if you just say, I chucked it in the fire, the guy in the high chair, the judge guy, could just say, well, then you accept it. And I find it very telling that politically motivated people were saying to people, oh no, don't return it to sender, burn it, or throw it in the bin. Because they've never said that before, as far as I know. They've never said that before. They never said what to do or what to not do, but I've never heard of them before, ever, saying to people, chuck it in the bin, burn it, but do not return it. Why not return it, politicals? Why not? I think somebody has let them in on a little secret that returning it would potentially destroy the ability of Irish Water to yank somebody through the courts claiming some form of constructive implied quasi-contract deal was in place. So I would question, if I was out there and part of these protests and all of that jazz, I would be questioning anybody in that manner who was suggesting I burn it, destroy it, or bin it instead of simply returning it. Now another reason, if you want to take it, just let's take a completely different approach, why return to sender? Well, ask yourself the following question. Is that envelope that arrives from Irish Water, supposedly, is that envelope addressed to you? I'm going to tell you, so far, none I've seen are addressed to anyone. Because the document that's inside, well, maybe that isn't addressed to you or your person, but the envelope is not addressed to you. Not if it's a window envelope, not if there's any glazing on there. As I said, maybe what's inside it is addressed to you. But enclosing that is not addressed to you. And if you open that, potentially, you could be done like that postman was done. I haven't got the results of that court case, actually. I think that was this week. I did actually ask somebody, could they sit in on that and let me know what happened. If you're listening in the chat box, and if you did check out that court case, could you please give me a little PM? If you attended, let me know what happened. I'll try and look it up on the internet. I'll play a song now in a few minutes. I'll try and look that up and find it. Or if anybody else has the link to it, please chuck it in the chat box and I'll click it. I think it was in the Independent about a week ago or thereabouts, a week and a half ago maybe. Postal worker from a post was taken to court for opening mail that wasn't addressed to him. So, I also believe that Irish Water then started to send envelopes with no windows to people. And again, I'm going to say to you, well, maybe it is addressed to you, maybe it isn't. A lot of them have the occupier on them. Case on October the 1st. Thank you, Dell. Okay, 1st of October. Well, we're not too far away from that, actually. That's one to watch, folks. Next Wednesday. Next Wednesday. Not to be missed. So, as I said, the envelope is not actually addressed to you. Therefore, the envelope is not your property. And you don't have the right to destroy property, surely. And apparently it's belonged to somebody else. Well, who does it belong to? Well, apparently it's belonged to Irish Water. So when you return it, you're just simply returning somebody else's property to them because apparently they made a mistake and maybe they made an honest mistake. Who knows? Thank you, Mr. T. So we're just sending it back to them. Return to sender. Somebody made an honest mistake, apparently. It really is that simple. I mean, if I sent you a letter addressed to your neighbour, most people would say, oh, somebody made an honest mistake. I'll just pop this letter into the neighbour's address. Maybe you're not getting on with your neighbour and you think, you know what? I don't want to drop it into my neighbour. I don't really get on with my neighbour. I'm just going to return it to the postal service and they'll figure out who it should be sent to. They'll figure it out. That's their job, right? That's what they do, yeah? When you return to sender, you are not interfering. That's very important. If you bin it, potentially you're interfering. If you burn it, potentially you're interfering. You've destroyed somebody else's property. Now, if you destroy it or bin it, they do get to claim you've accepted it. They get to claim that. They get to say, hey, we sent them a letter. We heard no objection. Nobody said they didn't want it. And don't you know, that's the very case that they're going to make the big show trial out of. And that's the one they're going to put in the paper saying, oh, look, somebody who did X, Y, and Z and it didn't work. Don't the media love telling you things like that? Oh, it didn't work. But we know it works. We know damn well it works. Question from Bluebell. Okay, Vin, what if it was opened accidentally? Then what? Oh, well, as long as it was opened accidentally. See, accidentally would imply it was an honest mistake. I mean, if you open mail for your neighbour accidentally, you know, you're ripping open envelope after envelope in the morning and you open the letter and you look and you go, dear Bob Smith, you think, hang on, I'm not Bob Smith. Oh, crap, I've opened my neighbour's mail in error. I've opened Bob Smith, who lives next door's mail in error. I think I'll just seal it back up and return it. And maybe it might be embarrassing, but I'll return it through the post rather than maybe the post will send it back to him and he won't know who opened it. It's that simple. This return to sender process is very simple. It's extraordinarily effective if done correctly. It's not the end of the process, folks. As Mr. T often said, look, this is not the end of the whole deal. There's more. There is more. Of course there's more. Will they send it back again? Of course they'll send it back again. Now, thank you. There you go. I was just about to say, and Annette Moore stuck it in the chat box. Some people are getting packs addressed to them. What then? If it's addressed to, you know, your correct, whatever you way you want to view it, your correct, what you would perceive to be your normal name and address, right? Depending on how you view things. Okay, but let's say your what you would consider to be your legal name and address, right? How about that? Well, somebody has just sent you an offer to treat. See, that's really what the envelope is. It won't become a quasi-contract or an implied contract or even a constructive contract unless you do one of the things required to enable that. Up to that point, it's like something on a shelf in a shop. It's an offer to treat. So something on a shelf in a shop and has a price tag of, say, 10 quid on the price tag and you think, oh, wow, that's a great bargain, and you pick up the item in the shop and you go up to the cash register and you say, I'll have that, please, thank you very much, and you pull out a tenner and they go, oops, hang on a second. They beep the barcode through the computer and it says, no, actually, that should be 20 quid. Somebody must have put the wrong price tag on it. Now, there are some shops, quite a few these days, who've said, you know, their store policy is they will look, we'll honour the lower price, just this, you know, they'll send someone down to the shelf to check to make sure the rest aren't priced at a tenner, and they'll be very quick to stick prices for 20 quid on them. However, they can actually say to you, I'm very sorry, which would happen more, say, in a small business, I'm very sorry, that was the wrong price that was on that, that's just an offer to treat, and that's a take it or leave it deal, so, look, you either give me the 20 quid, or you leave it. Take it or leave it, it's 20 quid. And you make your determination there and then. So it's exactly the same with that envelope. If it does have a name and address and no window on it, it's an offer to treat. Which, of course, is where it's up to you. You can put the return to sender label that we talk about on here, which is simple and clear. And I'm going to read to you exactly what it was before other people, as far as we know, began to get creative with it. And this was the language that the wonderful Mr. T provided to us. This is the information. Return to sender. I do not recognize you. I do not understand your intent. I do not have an international treaty with you. No assured value. No liability. That's everything. Mr. T never mentioned anything about putting no contract on it or anything else. He said, that's all that's... Again, look, folks, you don't have to take Mr. T's word for it. I would suggest it's probably, you know, when Mr. T said something, as I said, you know, I always paid attention. Every little word he ever uttered, you know, that's how he taught. I mean, as I said, he wasn't specifically ever trying to teach me as such. Well, I mean, he showed me stuff and he taught me stuff and he did. And when he did so intentionally, I'm sure. But as I said, even if he was talking to somebody else, I also sucked all that in too as second hand. I said, well, hey, he's talking or teaching somebody else. He's not maybe necessarily directing at me. I'm going to sit down, and if he doesn't object, I'm going to suck all this up too, like a vacuum cleaner. Because Mr. T, folks, when he spoke about these issues, it's like gold. Linguistic gold. The man is a genius. He's a genius. And as I said, I can't ever thank him enough, and I don't think anybody else will be able to either. So, somebody said, can I repeat that, please, Vin? Certainly, I'll repeat the language again. Well, there's the link. Look, I'll give you the link. If you click this link, you'll actually be able to see the language. Here it is right here. Just stuck it back in the chat box for you there, Bluebell. But I'm happy to read it again in case you're listening on the podcast. Return to sender. I do not recognize you. I do not understand your intent. I do not have an international treaty with you. No assured value. No liability. That's it. So, Mr. T would say, for example, well, hey, you know, if that's something along the lines of somebody maybe perhaps sent you an offer to treat, stick the label on it, wing its way back to them. It's pretty simple. I mean, it's not rocket science, as they say. You know, I mean, the information on the label, what does it mean? How will you interpret it? Can you interpret it? Return to sender. It's fairly simple. That's an instruction to the postal system. Anytime they see, even if they just see return to sender and nothing else, you know, postal system guys, they stop reading at that point. They just go, return to sender. Fine. Somebody wants it returned. Fine. They've no problem. That's it. They stop reading there. It's only when it arrives back at whomever the sender was, they'll notice return to sender. Oh, what the hell? I do not recognize you. I do not they're saying whoever sent this back to me is telling me they're offering me no recognition. And yes, it's a contract, if you will. They're also offering no understanding for our intention. They're not standing under our intention. They're not accepting our intention. They're saying they don't have an international treaty with us. Remember the call that we played there from the revenue commissioners to that caller? In fact, maybe I should dig that out. That's worth a play again, I think, because this was from revenue. Here we go. Have a listen to this, just in case you haven't heard this before. Somebody used a return to sender sticker, went back to the revenue commissioners. Revenue commissioners made a phone call, left this as a message on the answer phone.
I would like to leave a message. I'm calling from revenue offices within the compliance campaign. At the moment, your name came up in relation to outstanding returns to 2000. You can give me a call back. I don't have an international treaty with you. 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 But you can call me back on.
I don't have an international treaty with you. Repeated four times. No, I repeated it in the recording. I copied and pasted that in a couple of extra times. Because that tells you, that should tell you rather. I mean, that's genuine call, folks, from the revenue commissioners. No, I do have the original with the names and all that. But I wouldn't release it, you know yourself. But that's it. Clearly, when you use a return to sender label, it gets returned to sender. End of. That's what the postal system does. So, it's an offer to treat, you lash the sticker on it, and effectively what you're telling them is, we don't have a all of that language together. What you're really telling them is we don't have a contract. We don't have an international treaty. There's no assured value, there's no liability here, there's no nothing, I don't know. Not only do I not know what your intention is, I don't care what your intention is. What your intention may or may not be, hey, that's your business. I care not. Now, I understand some people are writing some, shall we say, language that would be known as a use of the vernacular on the envelopes. I don't think that's a good idea. I understand, and yeah, I know, it's quite funny in a lot of cases. But really, I think the people of Ireland, and anywhere in fact, using this methodology, I think we should try to maintain our dignity, you know, dignified approach, you know. And just looking at the chat box again there, no, Bluebell, absolutely delighted for you to ask these questions. Absolutely delighted. I mean, that's how we all learn, by asking questions and discussing. I mean, that's what we're trying to do here. So by all means, ask any question you wish. But, so effectively, even if it does have supposedly what you perceive to be your name and address on the outside of the envelope with, you know, not one of these window envelopes, no glazing. Yeah. Sticker on. Off she goes, and you are letting them know something. Now, I'm not recommending you do this. I'm not instructing you to do this. All I'm trying to do is explain to you the process as, you know, as close as I can, based on my recollection, if you will, as to how Mr. T explained it to me and to us and when he was on and talking to us about all this stuff. So, you know, I can't find anybody who'll tell you Mr. T steered him wrong. I don't know anybody who'll say that. Maybe somebody does. Maybe somebody out there does have that notion or idea. And if they do, I would imagine, more than likely, you know, under examination, they'll probably end up telling you at some stage or other, well, they didn't really follow exactly what was explained to them or something like that, and, you know, maybe that screwed the thing up. That's why we would be careful about adding any language to that label, folks, because we wouldn't want to be, you know, I wouldn't want to say to you, oh, add in, you know, sprinkle pixie dust on it and sign it in purple pen and da-da-da-da. I wouldn't want to be responsible. So I'm not accepting responsibility for that. I'm just explaining it to you as best I can from the way it was explained to me. That's really all. So once that's done, you see, if, for example, Irish Water attempted to bring a court case against you, and look, there's guys on here will tell you, look, they don't care what the hell comes to the door. It gets a sticker and it goes, you know, unless it's maybe a utility bill or something, but a lot of people have utility bills on direct debits, etc., etc. So, you know, they can pretty much, if they have their house in order, if you'll forgive the expression, they literally don't care what comes. It gets a sticker and it goes back, unless perhaps maybe it's handwritten, and handwritten with a stamp. Here's an important one for you. Let's say Irish Water begin to use the crafty techniques that we've seen others employ down through the years, whereas they know people are starting to cop on to some of this stuff, so they think, well, we'll just get a secretary or somebody who works here, Bob, in that office down there. Here, Bob, there's a stack of envelopes. Here's a list of names. Instead of printing up stickers, your job today, Bob, is to handwrite, you know, 500 names and addresses on all those envelopes. But you see, the thing that companies do, they all do this, they still need to keep it in the commercial world, if you will. So they generally run them through the franking machine. So if you got an envelope, even if it is handwritten, but it's got a frank, no stamp on it, you know, it's got one of those franking machine marks, then you know, well, that's a commercial entity that sent it to you. So you don't even have to think twice in that regard. You can say, well, hey, it's an offer to treat of some description, perhaps. Either way, I don't recognize them. Don't recognize the handwriting. Don't recognize the look of what, you know, there's no stamp. It's like a franking machine mark or something like that. So I'm returning that too. Now, let's say they go one step further. Let's say they get a load of the franked envelopes back too, and they're thinking, damn, these guys are copping on. Okay. And the boss says, well, here, just use ordinary. We'll go and buy, what's a stamp these days? I don't know, you know what the hell. What's the price of an ordinary stamp? The cheapest stamp, is it 65 cents or something like this? Whatever. 60 cents, 65 cents, something like that. Anyway, let's say they say, well, we'll just buy a ton of stamps, and we'll handwrite them this time. And that way, they won't return them. Now, they might say that to the legal department, and the legal department will say, well, you're still not clear, boss. And the boss says, what do you mean I'm not clear? You told me if I sent them an official envelope in a window, technically, I could run into difficulties. So then I used new envelopes with no window, with the name address printed on it, and I was running into difficulty because it's just an offer to treat. Then I was sending them a handwritten envelope, but with a franking mark on it. They were still returning it to sender because it's still perceived as an offer to treat because of the franking mark. Now you're telling me, even if I just handwrite everyone myself and use an ordinary stamp on it, I'm still going to run into trouble? How? And the legal eagle guy, if he's clever enough, will say to the boss, yeah, well, you see, the problem with that is All the other forms of mail were like in the public, and if you just handwrite it and stick a stamp on it, that's private. So if you send private mail, well, nobody has to acknowledge that they got private mail, right? You only have to make an acknowledgement for public mail, you see? Anything that comes in a private form, you know, I mean, like if I stick a lottery card into a birthday card and I post it to Gillian Trebilcock there in Australia, she doesn't have to announce to anybody. She got the birthday card. Maybe she might send me a little polite note over Skype. Thank you, Vin. Got a lottery ticket. You know, won a million. And she's coming over to see us. That would be great. But other than that, she doesn't have to inform anyone, right? No information is required. Why? Because it's a private communication. It's a private communique. It's in the realm of sovereignty. The private side of things. So, yeah, you don't even have to worry about that. You see? And if they try to sue you saying, we sent you a thing in the post. Really? By what means? Do you think they're going to stand up in a courtroom and say, well, we sent it to you privately. George is going to tell them, get the hell out of here. Privately? You mean that, you know, it's not a public, so it's not a public, this wasn't a public contract you were offering me. You were offering me a private contract? Yeah, well. Even if the courts feel you can be compelled somehow to be adjoined against your wishes to a quasi, an employed, or a constructive contract, maybe, they're sure as hell not going to say. They're going to back up you being adhered to a private offer of contract. Why not? Because otherwise, you and I could just send each other private offers of contract left, right, and center and come in, you know, whether you perform or not. I'd be able to take you to court, you'd be able to take me to court, and everybody would be taking everybody else to court. It would be mayhem. It'd be mayhem. There's no bloody way they could deal with that. And there's no way they'd have that. Not on your Nelly. So look, I hope I've covered as much of that as is reasonable for you. Hopefully you understood what I'm talking about, and you know, you have a good idea where not just me, but I mean, you see, when we meet up, the Sunday meetup, particularly the once a month meetup, guys, which is approaching, when is the next Sunday, in fact, following Sunday, the 5th of October, will be the monthly meetup, where hopefully as many people as possible will show up, and you should try and get to the next one, because, you know, the weather's going to start turning, folks. But, so, yeah, maybe do make an effort to get to the next one. I mean, there's always a few people there every week anyway, pretty much. And again, nice meetup today. A nice cup of coffee, some great conversation. It's always an interesting conversation. So hopefully I've done all that, and you know, you have a good grasp. And anybody has a question, by all means, sit down, have a thinky, write it out if you need to, and if you want to call in and let me know, by all means do. Vincent Temp 1 over Skype, that's VincentTemp, and the digit 1, Vincent Temp 1. Or 00353 if you're international, 1-44-33-09. So that's 01-44-33-09. That's a Dublin number, and you can call from a mobile, a landline, or from a galaxy far, far away if that's what's in your head. Usually 3 p.m. to 6 or thereabouts, so I'm not usually there exactly at that time, but that's usually in and around. And look, the meetups, they're not like official meetups, folks, or anything. It's a convenient place. It's a beautiful place. And, you know, we get together. We have a chin wag. It's nothing organized. Nobody's taking notes. We're not trying to discuss an agenda or, you know, point one of the meeting minutes last. We don't do any of that stuff, okay? It's just a general chit-chat. We just have, private conversations. But it's nice. We get to know each other. Really, that's what it really is all about, just to get to know each other. And it's nice. It is nice, you know. And I think it really makes a difference to not only our conduct with each other when we're there, but it keeps a nice buzz on the chat box. The guys know each other. We know each other. And that's, you can't beat that. And that I think it's part of our strength. But the more the merrier. So look, I'm going to play a tune, and I'm going to bring my guest on, hopefully. He should be there waiting in the wings. I've asked the wonderful, wonderful Clive the Carrot to come on, and we're just going to have we're not going to have a planned discussion in any way, shape or form, because I don't think myself nor Clive, we don't really like doing that. So we're just kind of going to wing it. And, we'll basically see how it goes. So while I get Clive on, I'll put this on for you. A little bit of Marvin Gaye. And, this one is Let's Get It On. and the wonderful Marvin Gaye. Let's get it on. Welcome back to peoplesinternetradio.com, and just welcome to a few new members who have just signed up again. In fact, some people who used to be members in the past off a different site, but however, they've signed up now again. Great to see old names that we know and got on with rejoining the site. And one of them I have on the line with me right now, Clive the Carol. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Thanks, Finn. Yourself?
Excellent. Just do me a favor. You're on the site there. See the bottom of the chat box? There's a little, it looks like a little wheel, like a little cog wheel. There's a smiley face on the right, and just underneath the list of names, there's a little, like a little gear wheel icon, and to the left of that there's a speaker icon, and if you just click the speaker icon and lower the volume down, we won't hear those plungs on the radio. Can you see it? Just at the bottom of the chat box, you see there's a list, see where everybody's listed in the chat box there?
Yeah.
Yep, down, right down at the bottom of that, you'll see a little speaker.
Yeah,
there we go, slide that down, and we're good to go.
Like a little antenna thing?
Well, it looks like a little kind of triangular. You see, there's a little green, a little wheel with a little green dot beside it.
No, I'm sorry, I don't see it. Shall I just log out of the whole site? That'd be easier.
Are you looking at the actual, you're looking at the site now in the chat box, yeah?
Yes. So my computer's seized up.
Right, that's what it is. Not to worry. Look, if it gets annoying, yeah, just log out of the site. If it keeps going bling, just log out of the site, and we'll just keep going. So anyway, Clive, first and foremost, let me just say, I've admired you, Clive, and what you've been doing and your work for a long, long time, and your attitude, particularly, I've always felt that it's just such a wonderful attitude to what you do, the way you do it. You're clearly a man who cares about people, and that's one of the things that, you know, for me, it's always had a big impact. Decency is a huge word for me, and it's a huge idea and notion that common courtesy and decency in people, I think a lot of people don't believe it's out there, and when I hear and talk to people like you, it reminds me, actually it is out there. I mean, that's one of the things I love about our meetups on Sunday. I'm meeting every Sunday, I get to meet decent, wonderful people. And I put you in that category too, Clive, because I've heard some of the stories about what you've done and who you've helped and selflessly have helped. And I know you've sent a lot of people stuff that they couldn't afford and you just sent it to them anyway. And I hope you're not blushing, because I think you genuinely deserve to be acknowledged for that. And I know you won't give out particular examples, and that's fine, and I get that too. But I'd like to acknowledge, I know people have told me in the past that you were very good to them and you helped them, and you knew they didn't have the wherewithal and you sent it anyway. So I would like to give you a thanks on their behalf, if you will, for that.
Well, thank you very much. You know, when that happens, you know, if I can afford it, I'll do it, because I always know that people will pay it back later. You know, it's if you suddenly get your health back after you've lost it, you know, you're going to be pretty bloody grateful, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but do you see what I'm seeing here? That, you know, the way an awful lot of internet sites out there, and there's an awful lot of raging going on, and it would be real easy to think that, bloody hell, the world is burning. And then you come onto our site and you see, look, so many of us here, we all get on, or 90% of us, we get on. And it's like decency central as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I think it's really important to concentrate on the positive. You know, you've got to have a tiny bit of awareness about the danger that might be around the corner. But I see so many people just wallowing in fear, mm-hmm. and watching, you know, the fear-based programs. And if only they could take a bit of action, it would be easy, you know. And I don't mean action like taking to the streets and marching. That always has been a complete waste of time as far as I've been concerned. But, you know, I mean, let's say the 3 million people who marched to stop the Iraq war. I mean, that was never going to work. It could have been 10 million. It still wouldn't have worked. If 3 million people had done something quite different, it would have had an incredible effect. Yes. I mean, you know, I'm not suggesting this is what they should have done, but what, for instance, if they stopped paying tax? 3 million people not paying tax. Now, that would have made the government pay attention. 3 million people who each decided to plant 100 trees. We'd suddenly be reforesting Britain, and the carbon dioxide hoax, you know, because all it is lack of trees. You know, it's not that too much human beings creating carbon dioxide. It's lack of tree, human beings cutting down the trees, creating a lack of oxygen. That's the problem. You know, we could make, 3 million people could, if they really put their mind to it, make a massive difference to the environment in a day.
In fact, I remember seeing, in fact, I think it was a British politician. Yes, it was a British politician. I can't think of his name, but it was a British politician. And I literally, hold on to your hat for this one. he was suggesting to sequester carbon, they chop down trees and bury them in mine shafts in England.
I mean, what really? Could possibly be wrong?
Yeah. That's one of my favourite expressions. What could possibly go wrong, yeah? But he had offered that up as an actual potential solution. Now, with the whole climate change deal, the way I look at it is, I've been looking a lot at the electric universe model. I think there's a chap on here, 80 McCady, I think he calls himself, or 80. He sent this to me quite some time ago, and I was looking at other areas. And in the electric universe model, they have basically said, look, we reckon we can prove it's the sun. It's not, you know, man couldn't even hope, they're saying, to affect climate. He says, we couldn't even hope if there was 20 billion of us or 50 billion of us, he said. It's a joke. No way could we even attempt to produce that much gas emissions that would potentially affect the environment and the climate. He said, not a hope. So he said, you know, when you look at the amount of gases Mother Nature adds to the equation every year and the way it deals with it, he said, look, it's a non-issue in that regard. Yes, the climate is changing. He said, yes, because there happens to be a big, huge flaming ball in the sky and with immense, immense power output, and it goes through phases, and those phases affect, guess what, our climate. Well, who could possibly argue with that?
Who would have thought today that big ball in the sky, all along it's been doing stuff, who would have thought?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's laughable. I mean, when you look at certain volcanic activity on the planet alone, you know, a volcano, I think I'm correct in saying an active volcano can pump out something like, in a year, something like 50 times, you know, of an average size volcano, something like 50 times what we can in a year.
But the real volcanoes are under the sea. It's the undersea volcanoes that put out more CO2 in a day than we put out in a year.
Well, yeah, and well, I was going to actually go even further and say that the ones under the sea, apparently, because of the way, because they enter into seawater, seemingly, that it's absorbed much quicker. And it has if anything, it would have a faster, more dramatic effect. And yet it's not.
I mean, it's the lack of trees, duh. You know.
Well, I mean, look, Ireland used to be 85% trees, seemingly, and I'm sure England used to be, you know, back in the day, as they say, you know, very, very heavily forested. Shouldn't we be attempting to return our countries to the natural state?
Yeah, so how many trees could one person plant in a day? You got 3 million people, how many could they plant in a day? Do you know what happened in Estonia when they decided to clean up the country?
Go on.
Well, this was a few years ago, maybe 7 years ago, and it's on YouTube. You put in country cleanup. And what happened was that over the years, Estonia had just become a dumping ground, and people had got into the habit of just dumping their stuff in the forest, you know, car tires, whatever, just dump it in the forest, and that was it. And it got so bad, you could see it from space. So these two guys had an idea that they'd approach Google, because you could see it from space, and ask Google if they'd map where the rubbish was. And they started, the two of them, the biggest campaign that Estonia had ever seen biggest advertising campaign on no money to clean the country up. And the idea was that they'd get everybody from the Prime Minister to all the companies that have got lorries to whatever to all get together on one day and clean up the country. And in 5 hours, they cleaned up the entire country.
Wow.
50,000 people took part, including the President.
Wow.
Because the population is only 1.3 million, 50,000, if you multiply that by the population of England, you know, that's almost 1 million people. It's like 1 million people, what can 1 million people do? Well, they could plant trees, they could clean up the country. You know, if only we actually utilize the fact that, let's say, loads of us are unemployed, well, actually, if we put our minds to it, we could change the face of the country in a day. Think what we could do in a week, think what we could do in a month.
That's fantastic. I love it. Well, okay. Well, I'm happy enough to try and start something like that here. Absolutely. We'll try and promote an idea along those lines. Because we're all about solutions, Clive, as you know, and that's what I love about you and what you do. You're all about solutions.
Well, yeah. I mean, let me ask you. I mean, you know, if you were in the mood, how many trees could you plant in a day? Well, if they were walnuts, how many of those could you plant in a day?
Exactly. I mean, yeah. I mean, I would suggest, you know, if, I mean, are you talking saplings or like from seed?
No, I'm talking, you take a walnut, And you shove it in the ground in the right at the right time of year.
Right, yeah, again, hundreds.
Well, exactly. Yeah. So how long would it take to reforest the place? Not long?
Nope. I mean, I did. I remember years ago when we started on the radio forest and it was under a different banner, but I said, look, you know, in Ireland and England, we should be literally able to walk out our door and think, you know what, I'm going to go for a walking camping trip and all I need is my tent and a few bits and bobs and maybe some emergency supplies. We should literally be able to eat our way across the country from the hedgerows as we go.
Well, we used to be able to.
Of course.
It wasn't that long ago.
Well, that's what I'm saying, because if you look at, say, some of the old movies, folks, I mean, how do you think the people, you know, back then, and look at what was the big one there recently, Vikings. You know, in Vikings, they fed themselves as they travelled from what was growing around them. Or maybe a bit of game here and there. But that's how they did it. How well? They didn't leave and think, right, when I'm going to London, I'm going to need 800 pounds of food and haul it with them. It didn't happen that way.
Well, you know, how we got enslaved, well, you know, what was with agriculture? You know, at the moment, they managed to tame nature and learn agriculture, then we could be enslaved and forced to grow crops. Then the trick was to wipe out all the food that we could have got for free, and we're trapped.
Well, exactly. I mean, if you look, I mean, I'm ashamed to say it to you, Clive, if you look into my front garden, you know, there's some wonderful plants out in my front garden, and it looks lovely. You know, my wife loves it, and she's very happy. We've got big, bushy plants of all sorts and types and description, but you can't eat anything off any of them.
Well, it's a farce. I was in Portland, in Oregon, some years ago, and the area where I was staying, what was extraordinary, was all the houses all had front gardens, and every front garden, pretty much, was overflowing with vegetables and fruits and so on, and a lot of them had signs saying, please help yourself.
Yeah. Now, I do have, I mean, I had the wonderful Sean McGuire with me earlier today. He paid us a visit, and he came up to his very first, we popped his cherry. He came to his first Sunday meet-up today, and we were out in my back garden, and he's just looking, and I'm going, yeah, there you go, have a look. Absolutely tons and tons of blackberries on the bushes. Just, I mean, I just literally have to stick out my hand, and there they are. So I'm going to give him a good go tomorrow. Somebody else suggested to me that he found a way on the site. He found a way to, he went and bought some empty punnets and some little, you know, a little bubble wrap paper, and he cut a little square and put it in the bottom. He went picking blackberries, you know, made sure they were good, filled his punnets, and went flogging them. And I think he said he earned something along the lines of €350 for a week.
Wow.
Just flogging them. And he said, like, you know, just walking through the countryside. He was picking as he was going and fresh air in there, you know. He said, plus I managed to... Oh, sorry, somebody just sent me a PM. Okay, well, lovely, thank you. The Postman case is under Judge Malone in Cork District Court on October the 1st. Judge Malone, Cork District Court in Cork. That's a bit of a mouthful. So if anybody's interested in attending, or they can attend, not to say anything, just to sit and observe and let us know what happens in that court case. If you take notes, that would be brilliant. Very interested in that one, folks. That would be... fantastic. And it was Lockrew Hills who made that suggestion. I didn't know if you wanted me to use your name, Lockrew Hills. But, yeah, and it was a brilliant idea. Am I right in the amount, Lockrew, that it was about 300 odd, 350, was that what you said to me? But it's that simple, Clive. And think of what he's selling to people. The best that the countryside can provide.
Well, there's no question, but blackberries are, you know, real superfood. I mean, fantastic, just full of absolute fabulous things. I mean, you know, despite the countryside having been ravaged, pretty much everybody has got cures in their garden for most things. I mean, you know, dandelions, you can use every single part of the dandelion, and they're everywhere. Nettles, particularly if you sort of put them in the food processor and blend them up with a bit of butter or cream or something, tastes fantastic, I think. Nettles make great tea. The nettle root has fantastic uses. You know, if you don't have to look very far. I mean, hawthorns, you know, there are lots of hawthorn trees all over the place. Fabulous heart remedy.
Well, I'll give you a laugh. 2 days ago, at the side of my house, there's like a hedgerow. And my bathroom looks out into the hedgerow. And the wife said to me, gee, that bathroom's getting very dark because there's loads of trees that are growing up at the back. And I thought, well, I'll have a look and see what's there. And I opened the bathroom window, and I'm staring at a bunch of apples. So, like, I literally just reached out my hand and plucked an apple from inside my bathroom.
Nice.
That's just brilliant.
You know, I think one of the things that people have forgotten is that we are animals, and what is normal for an animal. I mean, for instance, you know, imagine you see herd of animals in the wild, and they're, you know, the forest, whatever they eat is all still there. You know, flock of birds, school of fish. One of the things that you notice is that you can't tell the youngest from the oldest.
Mm.
All moving in harmony at the same speed, and in the wild, animals don't get ill. Birds don't get ill.
Not only that, for some reason, inverted commas says he, wink wink, you never hear of, oh look, we found another animal with a genetic inherited disease. They don't seem to have them, Clive, and yet we seem to have thousands of genetically inherited diseases. What's going on with that?
Well, you know, you ask a doctor and they might say, oh well, that cancer, it's genetic. But if it was 1% 150 years ago and 40 or 50% now, it's impossible that it's genetic. You know, most doctors saying this type of stuff haven't actually thought it through. So much of what is taken as fact is theory. You know, the idea that Crick and Watson had when they discovered, you know, genes, the DNA, that our genetics dictated our fate. You know, but it was always a theory.
Well, in fact, I'll go even further, because I remember the big to-do about all that, and I was quite young, but again, I was very into my science, always was, and I was always waiting for somebody to announce, well, yes, I mean, this is the DNA set up in your body, and here's how it operates, but really, it's the proteins that attach themselves to and from the DNA, which they do, folks. They attach to it, they release, they go do things, they come back. That's really where life, as we would know, the processes of life happen there, really, Clive, in that regard. It's not the actual DNA itself.
Well, you know, epigenetics show that you can override your genes. You can do it with nutrition, you can do it with thoughts. You know, many things can change your genes, and mm-hmm. the theory that they had originally just happened to be wrong. Just like, you know, Darwin's theory of evolution, it was just a theory. You know, Pasteur and his germ theory, all of them have been proven wrong for a very long time.
What I'd suggest is that the word theory, for example, has been, like many words, has been battered and abused by many for too long. Hypothesis is probably a better word to use for a lot of the presentments that we've been offered by the so-called establishment down through the years, because generally a hypothesis, what begins as an idea in somebody's mind, they form a hypothesis and they present it. And usually to become an accepted theory, it has to undergo repeatable tests. So for example, gravity began, if you will, the idea of, with the word gravity began, we're told, with Newton. And he came up with his hypothesis, and it could be tested, and we could test with ballistic trajectories and take a pound weight and use so much energy to fire it, and how high does it go, how far does it go, what. We could test it. I mean, they still use Newtonian mathematics to send a rocket into space, right? So that became a theory of gravity. I mean, gravity is a theory, even though many people might accept it as a fact. However, I came across what I believe to be a way more interesting hypothesis / theory for gravity by, he was an engineer known as Mark McCutcheon. Fantastic read. And I actually think it's a more accurate description of what's going on. He's basically saying that gravity is an effect, not a thing. You know the way in CERN, etc., they're looking for the Higgs boson and the graviton and all of these things in the LHC. But he's basically saying they can look forever, they're not going to find it, because it's an effect of something else.
Yeah.
So this idea that, you know, when you're talking about evolution and whatnot, yeah, I mean, do species have the ability to evolve within their subsets? What's known as microevolution, that seems to be a fairly reasonable, so far, theory.
I've never seen an animal in the middle of evolving. I've seen birds adapting.
Mm.
You know, in Victorian times with all the coal, the birds went from, you know, light grey to very dark grey, and then when they stopped the coal, they changed colour back again. I think there's adaption. I don't think there's evolution.
Well, this is what I'm saying, you see. The term evolution is really more closely linked probably to, as you say, adaptation. Whereas, I mean, you and I both know, for example, if we were barefoot and we lived in nice, bouncy, boggy, grassy meadows, our toenails would grow, and unless we found some way to shorten them, they'd kind of, you know, grow over the top of your toe and curl. But if you live somewhere where there's a lot of, say, stone, just through natural processes in your barefoot, that's going to wear it away. So I think the likes of, wasn't it the finches, the beaks of the finches, that Darwin was basing his assumption on, his hypothesis. And they actually call it the Darwin finches now, don't they? But, I mean, a finch beak is, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's a keratin product of the body of the finch, and that's just like your fingernails. So, you know, if I bite my nails, for example, and you don't, my nails are going to look different to your nails over time.
You know why some people bite their fingernails and other people don't? The people who bite their fingernails are so low on minerals that subconsciously they're being forced to recycle.
Wow, that's interesting. That is interesting because I actually heard someone else mention something like that, and they were also saying it's potentially to do with something, gut bacteria seem to notice what's going on in your body faster than anything, and they apparently somehow manage to communicate that with you, and you'll begin to do things like that, like bite toenails and bite skin. I knew somebody who used to, I don't know what you call that little bit of skin at the side of your finger, just at the top of the fingernail to the right and left. I knew somebody who used to, they literally ended up with open sores on their fingers because they were literally cannibalizing themselves. But they said they couldn't stop. There is a name for it. If somebody's on, they know the little bit of the beside the fingernail, what's the name for it? Let me know. But, what about that theory that your gut flora and fauna? I mean, are we, more influenced by our gut flora and fauna than we realize, perhaps?
Well, you know, the way to look at it is, who are we? Well, most people would believe that we're between whatever 50 to 100 trillion cells all acting in harmony to create us. And most people know from quantum physics that, you know, there's a tiny little bit of matter and masses of empty space, and we're really barely there at all. So, but in reality... yeah,
the closer you look, the less you end up looking at.
Yeah, but in reality, we're outnumbered 10 to 1, they reckon, by bacteria. So your body has got 10 times more bacteria than it has cells. So looking after your bacteria seems pretty bloody crucial to me.
Which is kind of funny when you think about it. If we weigh 10 stone, and supposedly, they say two-thirds of us as water, and if the other... What did you say? What percentage is bacteria?
But remember, they're very small and they don't weigh very much. In sheer numbers, there are more of them than us, but they're very small. They don't take up that much space. But you know, that what the scientists reckon is that 85% of our immune system is in our gut. And as our gut is primarily bacteria, you know, that's what sort of lines the gut, they're pretty important. So let's say that everything was perfect in life. So life would start, you get born, and they do not cut the placenta. The placenta is there for a really good reason. It's like the baby's packed lunch, you know. If the baby was born with everything it needed, it wouldn't fit through the birth canal, so it comes out in two parts. And the idea is the baby's got everything it needs for the next few days, and you just wait until the baby absorbs everything that was in the placenta, then it drops off by itself. So let's say you had a good birth like that. Then after that, let's assume that your parents realize that you have language at the moment that you're born. They realize that there are five sounds that every baby makes. Sounds like I'm hungry. Sounds like I'm having a poo. Sounds like I'm tired. That kind of thing. And there's a woman called Priscilla Dunstan on YouTube who teaches you how to recognize those sounds. So let's imagine your parents have understood the sounds that you've been making, so you've never had to cry during your life because they knew when you were hungry, they knew when you wanted to sleep, etc. Then let's suppose that you didn't have any vaccines, and so therefore you were pretty strong. Let's assume that you'd never been exposed to chlorinated water, so you'd never drunk any and you'd never had a bath or a shower in any. Let's say you'd never been to a public swimming pool and got chlorine that way. Let's say you've never had a drug from the doctor, particularly antibiotics, then your gut flora should be just fine, assuming you haven't been through too many x-ray machines, assuming blah, blah, blah. So, as most of us have had one of those things happen, we're going to have compromised gut flora. And what that may lead to is an inability for your immune system to work properly. And is it easy to get it back? Well, some people believe you could take some probiotics to get it back, but there are hundreds and hundreds of different bacteria in your gut, and there are probably only about 10 varieties in the best probiotics. So while you can regain quite a lot of benefit from probiotics, it's not the answer. The best answer, people aren't going to like. The best answer, was, and I don't like this one, there are a few people in the world who do actually tick all those boxes. They never have been damaged. And apparently, this is the bit that people won't like, if you take their feces and inject them into an ill person, within a very short time, the ill person...
Wait a minute, sorry, Glenn. Go back there in a second. Sorry, did you say take their feces and do what?
Yeah. There's a company at the moment who has found three people in Britain
mm-hmm.
who have never been exposed to anything that would damage their natural gut flora, the natural bacteria.
Okay.
It turns out that they've developed a system to completely purify it and inject it as a suppository back up some unfortunate ill person's arse.
Now, that's incredible, because when I moved out here to Balbriggan, at first 14, 15 years ago, whatever it was now, actually it was longer, 18, 19 years, the pub I used to drink in was full of farmers. And I used to love drinking in it because I used to be a city boy, and suddenly I was in the countryside, and I used to get to listen to these incredible conversations that there was no way I was ever going to hear anywhere before. And I remember this so well because it was the first time I was in this particular pub, and they were talking about taking care of a sick goat by taking goat shit from a healthy goat and shoving it up the ass of the sick goat.
Well, there you are then.
That's incredible.
Well, so it...
So there was, I mean, because I was just sitting there listening to this, going, these guys are mental. What you're telling me then, that sounds like that was the correct remedy.
Well, I know somebody who tried it.
Okay.
And they had, I think it was ulcerative colitis, which is pretty nasty. And within a very short time, matter of a couple of weeks or something, 95% better.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what about the likes of IBS, etc.? I mean...
Well, I think the same would apply.
Wow. I mean, it makes sense when you think about it. I mean, assuming that there wasn't too much damage. I mean, yeah, I mean, the idea of it is, you know, doesn't sit well, I'm sure, with a lot of people listening right now.
Obviously not. You know, somehow one would want to be assured, obviously, that everything's fine and it's being cleaned up in whatever way it's cleaned up. I have no idea. But that's just one of many, many extraordinary ways to get better that really are little known. And, you know, obviously, because it's not taught to doctors, they've got no clue. One of the other interesting ways is with ozone. You know, people of a certain age will remember that thing with Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones where he has his blood changed and suddenly he's all fit and well again.
Right.
What they can do is they can take out about 200 mil or something like that of your blood and ozonate it, bubble oxygen 3, ozone, through it, and then re-inject it into the person. And within the time it takes for the blood to circulate around the body, you know, 3 minutes or whatever it is, as I understand it, all the pathogenic elements like viruses and bacteria that you don't want, boom, gone.
Because O3 is like super reactive to these creatures, viruses, bacteria, they just pull it in immediately. Isn't that the idea? It's so reactive to them.
Yeah, it's a massive hit of oxygen.
Yeah.
And that, unfortunately, is rather expensive because you need a trained nurse to do it and, you know, it's pricey. So there are other ways to do it. The first time I experienced ozone like this, and it's important to make an important distinction, there are two types of ozone generators. There's the type that costs about 40 quid, which you ozonate water or you ozonate vegetables to kill the chemicals on them. Mm-hmm. That's the 40 quid version. But the type I'm talking about is a medical grade ozonator, and they're more towards the £2,000 mark. Anyway, first time I experienced one, this guy said to me, take your clothes off. I thought, anyway.
any conversation that begins with that, I go, what?
Yeah, exactly. So he said, get in the sauna cabinet, one of those ones where you stick your head out, but your body's in the cabinet. And he stuck in this tube to an ozone generator and switched it on. And literally within 1 second, I was thinking waterfalls, right?
Right.
And I said to him, that's really weird because this feels like it does near a waterfall. And he said, well, that's because ozone is created where water smashes against rocks, like by the seaside. You know, that smell is ozone. And by waterfalls. And it was really weird. I recognized it through my body in 1 second.
That is interesting because, again, what I'm going to say is, again, from my studies of the electric universe theory, as water passes over a rock and as it goes through pipes indeed and all sorts of things, which is why when you're, I mean, I was a builder, I used to know and understand about supplementary bonding electrically with the copper pipes in a house, that there's an electrical charge that will build up as water flows. And, you know, if it's coming down the face of a rock with, you know, speed, that would make sense that O3 would be generated.
Yeah. So,
again, tidal, same reason.
Yeah. So the other ways of doing it, apart from, a cabinet like that, a sauna cabinet, is you can get a large plastic bag and sort of wrap your leg up in it and put it in there and have it go through the skin that way. But the most effective way is to get a very small silicone bag and, take the bag with a tube, stick it up your bum again, and over a minute or so, you squirt just a tiny amount of ozone up rectally, and people have found they've recovered their health dramatically, ludicrously quickly with this method. And the main guy in England, who I don't actually know, I only know him by sort of reputation, a guy called, I think, Dr. Jack, he's run into all sorts of problems with the authorities for treating people. I think he's in his 80s.
Hmm.
You know, whenever a lot of doctors have success, they're not very happy.
Well, this is something that's coming up on a regular basis here. And we did have a little conversation about this earlier. And what's happening is not only are people falling, inverted commas, foul of the so-called system offering alternative health, really what's nailing them is they don't understand the use of language, particularly legally styled language. And they're making an awful lot of assumptions and presumptions and getting themselves into trouble. And I believe with some good education about some real simple aspects of usage of language that could literally change everything in the health industry back to where it should be, so that you can go to your local alternative health practitioner and not have a problem.
Well, unfortunately, the authorities are trying to physically block at customs the importation of certain items these days. You know, I used to be able to get glandular hormones, for instance, if somebody had a thyroid issue and wanted a natural glandular from an animal. You used to be able to import them from New Zealand, was a good place, you know, various places. But now they won't let you import it anymore. You know, I used to be able to sell herbs, I used to be able to make claims for herbs. But now, I can't make any claims anymore, even though for 10,000 years it might have been known about.
Well, you see, this is what I'm saying. I think if you let me look at the language that they're using, I think we, and, you know, you look at the language you're using, I think we may be able to overcome all that.
But, you know, you say to customs, okay, well, in the language that I'm using, you must let my product through. I still don't know whether they actually would.
You'd be surprised.
Okay.
I am talking from experience here, but I won't talk about it on air, okay?
Yeah, no, sure.
I wouldn't say it if I wasn't trying to give you a wink-wink.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I haven't got time for that. There's only one problem in the world, and that one problem is that psychopaths are running it.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is what, I mean, we were talking about cures earlier, and I asked you, Clive, is there a cure for stupidity? if we can find a cure for stupidity, and then if we can also find a cure for psychopaths, wow.
Well, what I've noticed with the psychopaths is often, you know, near the end of their life, when they really feel it is about time to retire, they usually sort of retire to their country estate and do the gardening.
Yeah.
So having observed that, I think one should cut to the end at the beginning, and everybody who is a psychopath in power currently, in whatever role, they should take up gardening. You just keep them away from the poison ivy. You know, I don't want to kill them or I'll be nasty to them. I just want to...
No, look, we've said that a million times here. That's not a solution. We haven't got enough rope, folks. You know? We just don't. And the structure of the system, there's nothing wrong, Clive. Most of the structure of the system is perfectly fine. The issues that we, the people, are having with the structure of the system is that it also has usury built into it. And that literally is the problem.
Well, quite. I had the Bible rammed down my throat at school, but if I remember it rightly, the only time that Jesus got really pissed off was about usury, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, what was it? We were interviewing the chap who did the, not the Zeitgeist, but the... the Venus Project. What was his name? Jacques Fresco.
Yeah.
And he had a quote that he used it here and there, but and I think it was attributed to somebody else. But somebody asked him about Christianity. Well, what do you think of Christianity? And he said, I think it's fantastic. When are you going to start it?
Yeah,
I mean, for some reason, people who follow religious doctrines don't seem to be able to quite work out that just because the inverted commas good book, whatever good book they read, says adulterers shall be stoned, they seem to think that that word shall is telling them to stone them.
Yeah, I think most adulterers probably are stoned at the time.
So what I mean, you know, as I say to people, well, you know, just like, if you will, the story of Jesus, well, he said, well, that he who is without sin cast the first stone. But it's the same idea as, well, I don't see your name. I mean, why have you got a stone in your hand? What's your name? Bob. Well, I don't see your name listed here, Bob. But the book says they shall be stoned. Yeah, but where does it say you, Bob, shall stone them? So put the stone down, Bob. You know? In fact, I'm actually reading a very interesting book at the moment, The Life and Inevitable Crucifixion of Jesus. It's called Trial. A very interesting read by Gordon Thomas. If anybody out there wants to get a copy, I can chuck in the ISBN into the thing for you. In fact, I'll read it. 978-0745-93-7540. So you'll get that on the podcast. Very, very interesting read. And again, this is looking at the trial of Jesus from a legal perspective. As in, they're trying to explore it. And it's not a religious text. It's what exactly was happening around the time with their versions of the legal systems they had. It's very interesting, read, Clive, because the methodology and the language that Jesus was using in front of Pilate, etc., was effectively the way we talk about using language, and it's a passive use of language, and that's where you respond, perhaps, but you don't answer.
I used to live in a village called Sherrington in Wiltshire. And they had got a little tiny, sort of, I don't know, whatever, 15th century church, or earlier. Anyway, they were redecorating it, and suddenly all the plaster fell off, revealing the original wall paintings from whenever it was. And presumably they'd been covered up with plaster in a hurry, probably because, you know, the Catholics were coming, or the Protestants were coming, or whoever it was. Anyway, what was interesting, they had the Lord's Prayer, but it was different to the one that I was taught. You know, it basically, you know, I can't remember what it is exactly, but Jesus was taken down from the cross or whatever, and then he goes to hell. And according to the Charrington Church, I'm just trying to find it on my computer to quote it to you. You know, he didn't go straight up to heaven; he went to hell. He came out of hell eventually. He got off lightly, but people don't seem to realize that.
That's an interesting one.
I'll find it for you later and send you.
Yeah, I'll be interested in having a look at that. But, you see, again, I mean, as I say, we're all about solutions here. I know you're all about solutions. And, you know, when I talk about these things, folks, I'm not trying to ram, and I know you're not either, Clive. We're not trying to ram anything down anyone's throat here. And I don't generally talk about my opinion on things. As in, I don't generally give my opinion when I'm on the radio. What I do is I try to explore the topic to try to share with people my understanding of a particular topic as best I can. I mean, you know, with best will in the world, none of us are professionals here. Somebody's asking Clive, he would have his own show or should have his own show. And I'd like to announce, and hopefully we can sort it out very soon, that yes, Clive is hopefully very soon going to have a slot on People's Internet Radio. Somebody else sent me another message there on Skype. That's fantastic. And again, just another one there, Joanne from... Joanne Summers from Amash, she too is looking for a slot on the radio as well. So there's two more coming in. How soon do you think we might be able to get this going with you, Clive, for example?
Well, we can do it right away.
Brilliant, because, you know, I think a lot of people are really keen to hear what you have to say. And as you're doing, you know, I mean, we're doing an interview here, but when you're doing your own show, I mean, what type of things are you going to be, what topics and what, you know, what are you going to cover?
Well, I've had a few series in the past. The main one, which is on YouTube, has been called The Health Revolution. You have to put in The Health Revolution. And I did about 30 episodes with the best natural health people I could find around the world. And the first one we did was with this woman, Natasha Campbell McBride, who had been a neurosurgeon, then her child got autism, and she decided to put everything into that, and she cured her child of autism. So the first program was about how to cure autism.
Wow.
And we've dealt with how to cure blindness, how to cure arthritis, and lots of different subjects. Anyway, what happened was we were putting them out under the UK column, and ATVOD threatened us with up to £250,000 fine unless we took them all down. And UK column felt that because we weren't willing to comply with, they wanted to regulate us, which meant we had to, I think, send information about what our programs were going to be about 2 weeks in advance because they're about health.
Mm-hmm.
And they accused us of being too television-like. So over 24
hours. Yeah, I mean, how dare you? How dare you?
I mean, how dare you,
in fact, Clive?
Well, I mean, we were so television-like that I did some of the programs from my son's living room over Skype, you know. It would be impossible to tell that from Panorama, you know.
Apparently, yeah.
So UK column had to take them all down, and unfortunately, while about 20 of them maybe had been copied by other people, 10 of them had gone temporarily, until UK column had enough time to somehow sort it out.
Well, I'd be very happy to put them all back up for you, and I guarantee you they'll go nowhere.
Well, Mike at UK Column has got them. He just hasn't got time to do it.
Okay, well, I know Mike very well, as you know, and I'll have a little word in his shell, like.
Yeah, well, brilliant. But I've got a few up on my name, Clive de Carle, on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And I do a few series about the place with other people. I do one called something like The Owner's Manual to the Human Body, with two guys.
Now that's an interesting concept. Do you know do you remember the Haynes car manuals?
Yes.
Do you know Haynes actually produced a manual like that for the human body?
Yeah, I've seen it. Yes,
yeah,
it's
brilliant.
And each week we do various subjects. The last 2 weeks we've actually been covering Ebola, which is a very interesting subject to say the least.
Can we get at that for a few minutes? Do you mind just taking a little sidetrack and doing Ebola, because it's all over the internet at the moment. Can we talk a little on that?
Well, sure. There's an incredible book called Dr. Mary's Monkey, and it explains the story of using vaccines as a bioweapon by the United States. And the cast of characters in this are just extraordinary. Basically, there are a couple of different labs in America who were given the job of creating particularly a cancer virus. And they wanted, for instance, to kill Castro using the virus. So the most well-known name that was involved in one of the labs was Lee Harvey Oswald.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
Wow.
And anyway, basically this book, and there are many others, describes the vaccine program that they had going on and how they did it and what they did and why. And you probably know that most of the vaccines, including Ebola, is patented by the US government.
Well, I'm delighted to tell you, Clive, I've never been vaccinated for anything.
Well, you're incredibly lucky.
Not only that, I was a home birth.
Wow, my word.
Yeah, which was quite unusual. But, and I've never had a filling in my head.
Well, amazing.
Mm-hmm. And I don't suffer ill health.
Good. Glad to hear it. I wonder whether you got to keep your placenta.
There was a difficulty at the time. So I bled through the navel until I was 7 years of age. But, and the funny thing, I mean, just to bring the religious factor in for a second, I was taken to a church to be baptized before I was brought to hospital.
Wow. That's
That was the way my father viewed things.
Incredible.
So, but okay, let's get back to Ebola. We're seeing all these headlines. Ebola victim in here, there, and everywhere, being shipped to here, there, and everywhere. And, you know, the tagline is, what could possibly go wrong?
Yes. Well, you know, how are they going to sell vaccines unless it's everywhere? But the fact is that...
So is that just good marketing? Is that what you're saying?
Well, you know, you want to make sure that there's fear. You know, what they're doing is they're moving fear around. And the thing is that if Ebola is as infectious as they said, and it was discovered supposedly in something like 1976, why has it taken till now to get out of the box?
Mm.
You see, there. You know, I've been on an advisory panel, an Ebola advisory panel, to some African countries recently. Sierra Leone being one of them. And there were, I don't know, about 15 of us, Patrick Holford, various quite, you know, prestigious sort of people, giving their opinion on what Ebola is and how to treat it. I mean, really, nobody knows how to treat it because it's so rare that nobody's ever had the opportunity virtually to treat it. So one can only go on other infectious diseases, particularly other hemorrhagic fevers.
Well, we're told, correct me if I'm wrong, we're told Ebola effectively turns your internal organs to mush. Is that true? Is that what?
Well, you know, I know as much as you know as to actually what it does, but there seem to be a number of effects where, you know, you end up bleeding to death internally, and, you know, it's horrible. You don't want it for sure.
So it's kind of like a super duper version of multiple organ failure, collapse, disintegration. So, you know, that description is not a bad description, in other words. No?
Well, I imagine so. It doesn't get much worse, you know, okay. 5 days and you're toast. Supposedly. However, the point is that what really kills people, people no longer really die of cancer these days, they die of chemotherapy. Arguably never died of AIDS, HIV, they died of the drugs they were given.
What was it, AZT, that huge, massive combination of drugs, wasn't it?
Originally? Well, you know, as I understand it, the gay population was abusing the amyl nitrate poppers, weakening their immune system. They may also have been vaccinated, who knows? But the point is that Bill Gates, for example, I think has announced recently the eradication of polio in India. There were, whatever, 64,000 cases of polio a year. He's eradicated it with the vaccines, and lo and behold, a new disease called non-polio encephalitis, which has about 64,000 new cases every year, has popped out of nowhere.
But let me guess, somebody somewhere has a business model and a vaccine that they claim will take care of that once somebody pays a few quid.
No, well, Bill Gates has already eradicated polio, and all they've done is change the name of polio, and it's cropped up as this new disease, and they're claiming total success. It's a farce.
I'd rather he eradicated polo.
But the thing is, all one's got to do is look back in history at vitamins and how they were used. There was a doctor called Dr. Frederick Klenner, who was around in the sort of 50s, 60s, and he believed that using very high doses of intravenous vitamin C would cure every infectious disease. So over about a 30-year period, he tested his idea, and he proved that high doses of vitamin C, and we're talking something like 200 grams, you know, like a bag of sugar, intravenously of sodium ascorbate, every 24 hours, was curing polio, mumps, measles, scarlet fever, TB, pneumonia, you name it, including anthrax, every one. So it's reasonable to assume that vitamin C would probably...
You've just used what has become known as the C word, I believe, in the alternative health movement, that this word cure...
I'm reporting what he proved.
Oh, no, I know. But what I'm saying is I would probably use a different word. I would use relief. Are relieved.
Yeah, well, whatever.
But, you know, this is what I'm trying to get other people out there thinking, that the language you use, you know, I mean, if we start to use alternative descriptions, they will become common parlance.
Yes, okay. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think at some level, some of this stuff is just so ridiculous. It's so historical. It's massively available. And, you know, if somebody was making a claim without substantiation about the cure word, well, okay, you can see why people might get upset. You know, you've got no proof. Mm-hmm. But 30 years by a medical doctor who proved it clinically, with much substantiation since, I think in certain circumstances, any court would bow to, the clear evidence that, it was true.
Yeah, and you see, this is the problem again, isn't it? It's you know, all of this stuff is hitting a legal-styled courtroom. It's not hitting... I mean, you know, there was a suggestion, I was looking at something through the week, for example, for scientists, that there should be the equivalent of a scientific court. You present some theory or hypothesis, and, you know, I know they claim the peer review process is supposed to be that. It just doesn't cut the mustard half the time.
Well, peer review are the guardians at the gate. To get something peer reviewed, three people have got to look over it and say it makes sense. But because those peers are figures of the establishment, the status quo, by the very nature of peer review, they're unlikely to say it's any good because it disagrees with what they were taught.
Yeah, you're finished before you start.
Yeah, peer review is a joke.
So, which is why, I mean, that suggestion that there could be, say, an internationally recognized scientific court to present to wouldn't necessarily be a bad idea.
Well, maybe, but, you know, things are moving on. I mean, the American government, or whatever, 2 days ago announced that anybody who claims that they can cure Ebola will be arrested. So they shut down a colloidal silver company, they shut down a couple of essential oil companies, because both of them, you know, suggested that their products might, because they've been shown pretty much to overcome every other infection that you might otherwise be vaccinated for.
So but you see, that's what that is. That's a political statement there. They're coming out and they're saying, we own Ebola, folks. Cures are us. Everybody else is infringing on their turf, and we're not going to stand for it. It's gang warfare, isn't it?
Yes, and you know, they're basically saying, if you don't agree with us, you're a terrorist. Simple as that.
Well, Cameron quite recently came out with something. We were talking about it earlier. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, yes, I mean, this is deeply shocking. Speaking, I think, at the UN, he says that we must fight terrorism, and we must look for extremists, and no stone should be unturned, and we should use military force if necessary. And I'm paraphrasing, that people who believe conspiracies like that 9/11 was an inside job, or 7/7, are equally dangerous and should be considered, what's the word? Terrorists. What's one under terrorists?
Well, he all but used the term terrorist.
Yeah, he did use another term, but I can't remember.
He did, and it's not springing to mind at the moment. But, effectively what I found interesting was, he said all, maybe I should look up that clip instead of trying to recall. But it was something along the lines of, even if they're peaceful and passive, you know, if they have these ideas in their head, it was effectively, the ideas are dangerous. You know, even if you know, in other words, it's, don't even think about having this idea in your head. We told you what it was, accept it, shut up, and move along.
Yes, I mean, things have been taking a sea change in the language that we've been hearing them use in the last few days, and I think people more than any time now really need to wake up that, you know, the internet is being censored. I've been censored.
Yeah.
You know, on YouTube. I mean, they're censoring the internet, they're taking down the information that they don't want you to hear, and it's getting worse by the day. And if you can't talk down the pub about 9/11 without fear of being arrested, you know, it's worse than the Third Reich.
And on top of that, of course, if you do talk about 9/11 down the pub, somebody somewhere is going to inform on you, just like in Big Brother 1984, and they'll probably get a little reward, or they'll get an emotional reward. See, I think a lot of people confuse what rewards are. Even a pat on the back from authority, some people view that as an award or a reward. And, you know, that can drive that can have a psychological effect on people. And before you know it, I mean, we're in the middle of 1984. I mean, we already have it with social welfare. People are encouraged to rat out their neighbours. It's incredible. And what's even more incredible is people are doing it. Now, I know people have, you know, disagreements, etc., but they're using it literally as a weapon to, you know, somebody doesn't say hello to them on the street, and they're using it as a weapon to out-teach them, and they're reporting them.
That's horrible.
But it is. I mean, I know of people that have done that, and I know of people who have literally been victims of it. And yeah, but this is going on. I mean, I hear people talking, you know, saying, oh, humanity is waking up. Well, we're waking up a shower of grumpy bastards, if that's the case, excuse my expression, because, you know, I'm finding I come across a lot of people who claim to be, inverted commas, awake or enlightened or aware, and yet if I go to their Facebook page, I'm seeing them flare up and flame off at other people, and you know, then they come on and they do a radio show. Hello, everybody. Peace, love, light, and harmony. And I'm thinking, oh, who the F do you think you are? You know, you were on my page or someone else's page 10 minutes earlier, flaming off. I mean, I haven't made this announcement in quite some time on radio, but I'm going to make it again. It's due. If anybody listening online is or a member of the site, and if you're of a violent persuasion, do us all a favor. Please leave. We don't want you here. We're not looking for that. We're seeking passive, peaceful, effective solutions. And violence is never a solution. It can't be. It just can't be the solution, Clive, can it?
Well, obviously not. I mean, yeah, the biggest problem in the world, other than the psychopaths, as we discussed, is lack of money. Yeah, most people's depression is, at the end of the day, because we're having the life squeezed out of us by slavery. Yeah, my definition of slavery is where you do all the work and you just have enough money to barely survive, so you can't leave because you're trapped in the system. So that's where we all are, one way or another. And it is easy to see a way out of that one. Just to digress for a moment, I did this interview with this American doctor, a medical doctor, super bright, black American woman, Harvard educated and all that. And after she'd become a doctor, she decided she'd practice back, as she put it, back in the ghetto. And all of her clients were black. Every single patient was black. And after about a year or so, she realized that she wasn't getting the patients better like she thought she was going to. And she wasn't the success rate.
This was standard medicine, inverted commas, allopathic standard medicine she was practicing, was it?
Yeah, precisely. Okay. So she decided that nutrition was the way forward. So she put every hour she had studying nutrition and started turning her patients over from pharmaceutical allopathic medicine to nutrition-based medicine. And she was getting fantastic results, amazing, amazing results. So a bit of time goes by. And then one day, one of the drug reps comes in and says, why aren't you prescribing drugs anymore? You must be buying them from another company. You know, we can do a better deal. And she says, no, it's nothing like that. I've discovered nutrition. I just don't need your drugs anymore. Anyway, he goes away. And then she gets a phone call from the hospital. The hospital says, so why aren't you sending patients to us like you used to? You know, are you using some other hospital? Maybe we can cut you a better deal. She says, no, it's not that. And explains about natural medicine. Anyway, to cut a long story short, the interview I did with her was from Panama, because they struck her off and put her on the terrorist watch list.
Wow.
Anyway.
In response to Delamitri's comment, absolutely. He said, one exception is self-defense is okay, and natural law is that the aggressor is wrong. Absolutely, Del. I said, violence, not force. I have no problem with somebody using defensive force, ever. So that's why I use the term violence, because if you're using violence, you're using force to violate, whereas force itself is not wrong if you are being aggressed against. So thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity to give a clarification. Sorry, Clive, go ahead.
Yeah, so one of the things that she discovered before she left America, she heard that the slaves had a secret remedy that only they knew about, and that she started hearing stories that what would happen occasionally would be that if the slave master couldn't be cured by the doctors, that they would come down to the slave quarters and beg to be cured. And obviously the slaves would extract their price, whatever they could get out of the slave master to cure them. And so she began to try and find out what this magic remedy was, and she realized it must be free, because obviously they had no money, and it must be natural, clearly, and it must be something that was available across various areas of America, because she was hearing the story from several places. And anyway, she quickly found out what it was. What they were doing is they were tapping the pine tree, and they were getting the essential oil of the pine tree, and they were administering the essential oil. And what they did is that, you know, I think this is how it's done. They take the sap of the pine tree, distill off the essential oil, and then what they do is they put it on a sugar cube and give it, and it would be a really superb remedy that would often work. So they called it pure gum spirits. Pure gum spirits. Now, artists will recognize the term pure gum spirits, because the name that they gave to...
Sorry for interrupting you. A pine tree? It would have been a southern yellow pine, probably, yeah?
Well, I think all pine trees probably will, you know, do this anyway. The substance.
Well, just I'm just thinking where the you know, the bulk of the black slaves were. It would have been probably southern yellow, which is I have other reasons for saying that to you, because I used to work a lot with timber and southern yellow pine.
Right. Well, I don't know, but the fact is that we're familiar with this product because pure gum spirits are otherwise known as turpentine.
Yep.
And so she was explaining that she decided that she'd experiment with the turpentine, but she was really, really frightened about it because obviously...
we're told turpentine ingestion is toxic.
Well, of course, there's turpentine substitute as well, so you've got to be careful if you're going to do this, that it was real turpentine, not a substitute. But anyway, I mean, you buy a bottle of turpentine, it's full of, you know, skull and crossbones or whatever it is.
Mm.
Anyway, she researched enough to decide it was safe for her. So she tells her secretary that if she's not in by 9:30 to cancel all the patients, because she's likely to be dead, and she tries it on a, you know, a sugar cube, nothing happens. So she decides another day to try it again on 2 sugar cubes, nothing happens. Then she doesn't dare go to 3, but she goes to 2.5, and apparently everything happens at once. She said the brain fog lifted. Suddenly she's thinking clearly again. And she listed a number of other changes that she noticed to her you know, way of feeling. And she started giving it to her patients, and she realized that it was overcoming candida. It was overcoming parasites. It was having a number of very interesting effects on the body. Before anybody thinks of rushing out and trying it, you have to prepare your body in advance of doing it. It's something that needs to be done with intense study, and one should only look at it when one's entirely sure one knows what one's doing.
Right, well, here's why I kind of, my ears pricked up when you said that, because, again, I've looked at the health aspects of a lot of carpentry timber workers across the world, you see. And people who worked, you know, primarily with different timbers came down with different afflictions. Some of them didn't seem to come down with anything. You know, for example, walnut. You know, if you're turning walnut, you know, and if you get it too hot, the smoke that comes off walnut, that's a really toxic, noxious product. But, you know, wood turners in particular, because wood turners would tend to have their hand on the lumber as it was spinning on the lathe, and they would be getting the oils. You know, they'd absorb the oil over time, you know, over a 30-year period, you're going to absorb a lot of the natural oils of the timber, etc., and the timber product through your skin and your hands. And they didn't suffer from all these other afflictions that a lot of people were getting around them. Even in America in particular, it was quite interesting, because in the Depression, anybody who worked with timber wasn't falling foul of these other, like, diseases that were wiping out huge communities, that the carpenters all seemed to be okay.
Well, that makes perfect sense, because some of the most therapeutic oils are made from things like cedar and pine and juniper and so on. And, I mean, there's every part of the pine is useful. There's, you know, the pine is probably king of them in a way. And
another interesting thing, I don't know if you're aware, butcher's blocks. You know, the old butcher block in your old butchers. They were made from beech tree, Fagus sylvaticus, beech. And I remember going back a few years in Ireland, suddenly these new butcher blocks appeared in everybody's butchers, and they were supposed to be super hygienic. They were a big white block. I don't know whether it was nylon or phenolic or something like this. Plastic, effectively. Something like that. And eventually they realized they were breeding grounds for bacteria, and they had to get rid of them all, and they had to go back to the actual Fagus sylvaticus, the beech wooden blocks. And they realized the wood, even though it was, you know, maybe chopped down and seasoned and 40, 50 years old, after it was a 500-year-old tree, it was still killing bacteria.
Yeah, incredible power of trees and essential oils of all types. I've become very, very interested in the power of essential oils. I mean, getting back to Ebola, you know, there's a fantastic story from the 14th century about the Black Death, you know, the plague. And, you know, nobody would dare go into the house of a plague victim, where the plague victims had died, you know, because you might get the plague. And, but there were a group of thieves who were very adept and had totally fearless about going into all the houses of the very rich dead and stealing everything that wasn't tied down.
Right.
When they finally caught them, they forced them to tell how they'd done it. And they explained it was essential oils. They'd wrapped, like a scarf around their mouth and, nose, and were breathing in the essential oils of oregano, thyme, rosemary, that kind of thing. And they were immune because, no self-respecting virus can live in, you know, the fumes of those essential oils. And they called it thieves' blend. So wow. The argument is that, if thieves' blend was spread around a hospital, that infectious diseases wouldn't spread. And this was proven in the First World War because there were a lot of deaths in the field hospitals of England and Germany, but there are several field hospitals in France who are very keen on essential oils that they sprayed thieves' blend into the air of the field hospitals, more or less killing infections. And, you know, like guerrilla gardening, I was thinking guerrilla fragrancing would be a good idea. You go into hospital with some thieves' oil and shove it on the air conditioning.
Except the problem in this modern day and age is if you get caught, you were a terrorist trying to spread blah, 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 blah.
Yes, obviously this is a suggestion.
Yeah, so that's not a suggestion, folks.
You know, all this stuff is so proven. Of course, nobody knows with Ebola, and because of the law they've just passed in America, anybody who claims that something might cure Ebola could be arrested. And as we know, the Americans have declared that they can arrest anybody anywhere.
And not only that, they declare they can actually kill anybody anywhere.
Oh, that's sweet of them.
I mean, it's like...
At least unlike China, they don't bully for the bullet.
Yeah, some crazy stuff. Clive, I need to take a tea break. So I'm going to put a song on, if that's okay.
Cool.
And I'll be back to you in a few minutes, folks. You're listening to peoplesinternetradio.com. I'm interviewing the wonderful Clive Carroll. And I'm going to play this one for you. This is a bit of Boston, More Than a Feeling. It's an oldie, but it's a goodie. You can't beat the old ones. Boston, More Than a Feeling. Clive, you still with us?
Yeah, I am.
Excellent. Yeah, I do like some of the oldies. Look, I'm an old fart, folks. What do you expect? I know. Would I be right in thinking, Clive, you're in around the same as myself, 45-ish?
No, you're wrong.
Oh, more or less.
I'm 60.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't look it.
Well, thank you very much.
Wow, I'm actually shocked. Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Is that an up-to-date photograph I'm looking at of you?
Yes.
Okay, clearly I need to come visit you.
I look younger now than I did 10 years ago.
You do? Well, I mean, I would have said 50 at a push. And that was a push. That, you know, that was a push.
Yeah, well, I'd like to say everybody says that, but they don't, actually. But nevertheless, I have found a few of what I think are real keys to health, or they certainly were for me. I mean, I work with a medical doctor from time to time, and he told me about vitamin D. You know, he said, look, you're getting colds. You don't need to get colds. Just take vitamin D. You know, you got to, you know, eat fairly right. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the moment I supplemented with vitamin D, that was the end of colds and flus about 10 years ago. I thought, wow, yeah, that was good. And vitamin D costs nothing, you know, pound a month or less.
So what's a good source of vitamin D?
Sunshine.
Oh, okay.
You know, when they got to D, you know, they discovered A first, you know, when they got to vitamin D, they actually thought it was a vitamin. It's not. It's actually a hormone. And somehow hormones sound so much more important than vitamins. Anyway, you get vitamin D from the sun. And I went into the doctor's surgery to have a laugh. They get so scared when I go in. And I picked up one of these brochures, and it said, the flu season is coming. Get vaccinated now. And I thought, well, look, come on. Do you really, doctors, believe there's a flu season? You know, do you believe that, let's say, that the flu viruses have been hiding behind the cupboards in your living room suddenly pop out and attack people in winter? You know, is that what the flu season is? That the flu suddenly proliferates in some way when it gets colder?
Well, you see, again, I don't know if it's because I was never vaccinated or any of that stuff, but I don't mean... I don't get sick, Clive. I've never actually been, inverted commas, sick, thank God, touch wood and all that. Like, ever. I got a thing, what do they call it? Streptococcal throat. Uh-huh. And that nailed me. I mean, that nailed me for about 5 days. But that was it. I mean, I can't ever remember being sick, other than that, ever in my entire life.
Well, you're jolly lucky. But, I used to get colds and flus all the bloody time. I mean, you know, it's not just vitamin C. There are other things that are important, like zinc and, sorry, not just vitamin D, rather. You know, vitamin C and zinc are also pretty important. But the point is that they don't teach doctors what they really need to know, just like they don't teach us at school what we really need to know. I mean, what you really need to know, for instance, is what you're made of. I mean, you know, your brain is made of primarily water, which pretty much everybody knows. So if you're dehydrated, your brain doesn't work properly, or no reason to drink good quality water. But the solid part of the brain, the doctors clearly don't know what the solid part of the brain is made of, because if they did, they wouldn't be recommending statins, for example. Your brain is made of cholesterol, primarily. Cholesterol and fat is what primarily makes up your brain, amongst vitamins and minerals and so on. But it's basically fat. And so when Professor Alzheimer, about 70-odd years ago, for the first time noticed this weird brain-wasting disease, which he'd never seen before, nobody ever had, you know, it was so rare he had to call it after himself. He called it Alzheimer's disease. And it happened just shortly after Monsanto brought out margarine and brought out the new ways of making oil. And when people started following the ludicrous lie that low fat, low cholesterol is good for you, Alzheimer's and dementia took off. And unfortunately, anybody, you know, there's still people now who think skim milk is good. They think that skim milk powder is good. They think that semi-skim milk is good. They think that pasteurized dairy.
Yeah, because it's advertised on the TV as the healthy option.
And nothing could be further from the truth. In the same way that people are using antibacterial soaps.
Right, am I right in thinking, I'm going to make a couple of comments here. Number one, I've always attributed my general good health to the fact that when I was reared, we weren't rich, but we weren't poor, but we weren't in the middle either, I can tell you. We were kind of like the bottom end of the middle, right? I grew up, Clive, eating what's known as plain good food. Nothing fancy, just plain old, you know, and pretty much everything was home cooked or home prepared. You know, we didn't eat out of packets when I was a kid. And it was, you know, butter, full fat milk with the cream on top, no homogenized products. And that was how I was reared. It wasn't fancy, but you know, we were never hungry. I put it that way. And like, for example, my grandmother lived to be almost 104. I think she was 3 weeks away from being 104. And every day she had her bacon, her cabbage, her potatoes, a little drop of whiskey in her tea with cream, I might add, full fat cream in her tea.
Good.
And she had slabs of butter, and she even smoked, you know. And she said to me, and I've said this so many times on the radio, because we used to say, what's the secret to long life? And she used to say, eat well and don't worry about anything you can't do something about.
Well, she's so right. I mean, you know, let's say that somebody gets a cancer diagnosis, which turns out later to be wrong. Okay. Just a false diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
They go to the doctor and the doctor says, you've got cancer. In the week following that mistaken diagnosis, their risk of dying of a heart attack goes up 25 times.
Just from giving them that information?
Yes, nothing to do with the fact, just simply that they heard
that's
information that frightened them to death.
That's interesting, because I've used this quite a few times on the show and talking about what mail does to people. You know, when somebody gets mail in their letterbox and it's, you have been fined, we're coming to get your house, it's like a voodoo spell. And people open it and they read it and it goes in through their pupils, into their mind, straight to their heart. We use the expression, I read the letter, I read the notice, and my heart sank.
Yeah.
And I think you go into it, inverted commas, doctor, and they tell you, oh, you have cancer. Everybody will tell you, oh, my heart sank. It's the same expression. It's like a spell.
Well, you know, a good example would be, let's say you're having a great day, right? Fantastic day. There's a knock at the door, and you answer the door, and the person says, I've got really terrible news. Your child is dead, right? No matter how good your day was, you'll have plummeted to the depths, okay? Yeah. And if somebody said to you, well, look, how long is it going to take you to get over this tragedy? And you'd probably say, I'm never going to get over it. It's going to be affecting me for the rest of your life, most of my life. And then the next moment, there's another knock at the door, and the person says, I'm really sorry, I got the wrong house. Your daughter's fine. Your child is fine. Now you've gone from ecstasy to ultimate misery to ultimate ecstasy. Everything's cool. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. It was just a series of thoughts. So if a series of thoughts can change you from ecstasy to misery to ecstasy, and nothing happened, you can do that to yourself. It's called self-hypnosis.
Yeah. Well, again, I mean, I use a lot of techniques to help people when it comes to this type of thing. Particularly, we have people coming to us and they look, we've all these debts and worries and what the hell do we do? And you're saying you have some type of solutions available. What are they? And I usually tell people, look, you need to divvy out your problems, what you perceive to be as problems, but not actual problems, just divvy out what you perceive to be a problem. And I use that type of language so that they can put it outside of themselves. As, you know, if I hear people talking about my credit card debt, my bank loan, my mortgage, I say, stop. Refer to it as the credit card loan, the credit card debt, the mortgage. Externalize it, number one. And now let's examine each one and let's find some potential solutions and remedies for you. Some of the issues that people will, inevitably offer up are how they feel about things as opposed to the actual, they confuse the idea of how they feel about it with how they're going to deal with it. You see where I'm coming from here?
Yeah.
So I'd say to people, look, see that aspect of that there, how you feel it might affect you in your social circles, whatever. I want you to put that, pretend you're putting that into a helium balloon. And that helium balloon is attached to your wrist on a string. And you feel it bobbing in the air. And I get them to say, right now, cut the bloody string. And it's amazing. It really works. If you get them to visualize it, imagine you're holding it, and they get them to say, hold that scissors and cut it. Cut the string. And let that just float away. Because we can't do anything about that. So let's not focus on anything we can't do something about. Let's focus on what we can do something about. And usually that's where fear relief comes into it. And eventually I get people to understand, look, you're only fearful of this because you don't really understand it. And your fear is really a combination of lack of understanding and confusion. And when you clear that up, and now I can give you some language that you can use confidently because you're going to understand the language I'm going to tell you about. Now, even if external parties approach you, you'll be confident in what you're saying. You'll be telling the truth. You won't be lying. You won't be trying to be evasive or avoiding anything. And you can deal with it straight on. And it changes people's lives, Clive. Completely.
It's, sounds an important technique. And, I'm all for these very, very tiny techniques because clearly,
it's an in between the cracks technique, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
it's taking the brain by surprise so the subconscious gets it.
Mm. Well, I've had so many emails from people down through the years who literally told us, and other guys on the radio here that had we not been here, they wouldn't be now.
Wow.
I mean, literally what we're doing and what we're attempting to do, which is why, I mean, we're quite guarded about how we go about this. I mean, I know I am. I know the other guys are that, that's why we're saying, look, we're not a hang 'em high website. We're a seeking solutions website. If anybody has a solution we haven't heard about, we're saying, well, come on, let's hear about it. We're just trying to help ourselves, help each other, and let's improve things. I mean, if we can't do it, Clive, who can?
Well, quite. And everybody can help everybody, because when you realize, as I was saying, for instance, that your brain's made of fat and water, if you know anybody with dementia and Alzheimer's, you now know how to cure them, essentially. Obviously, I'm using that word again. But this, I'm just reporting the research that I've found of other people's work, right?
Well, Alzheimer's, am I right in thinking coconut oil, really high quality coconut oil? It's like a wax, almost looks a waxy kind of a substance. But apparently for the likes of people suffering from Alzheimer's, coconut oil is having an amazing effect, seemingly.
Well, I read about this a few years back and, because I give talks around the place from time to time, I started talking about it. And I said, give six tablespoonfuls of coconut oil to people with Alzheimer's, put it in their porridge, put it in their soup, put it in their food, give it to them off by the spoonful, mix it in with their hot chocolate or their whatever, any way you can get it.
Just get it into them.
And anyway, I was expecting, maybe in a year's time, somebody might phone up and say something had happened. Anyway, 6 weeks later, this woman rings up and she said that she'd had to stop speaking to her mum on the phone 2 years ago because it was impossible. You couldn't understand a word she was saying. And she tried to give her mum six tablespoonfuls of coconut oil every day, but she wouldn't go for it. But she did usually manage to get four tablespoonfuls in her. And after 6 weeks, she was able to speak to her on the phone again.
Wow. And that is incredible. I mean, I've seen family members go through that and eventually pass away. So that's incredible. There's a couple of questions here for you, Clive, if you're willing.
Sure.
Hi, Vian, can you ask Clive if he knows about Lyme bacteria, Borrelia burgo? I'm not even going to try and pronounce the rest of that. Pretend I did in the podcast, folks. causing more and more problems, i.e. such as Alzheimer's. It imitates many illnesses, apparently. And also, can you ask him if he knows much about ropeworms being found in increasing numbers, i.e. in autism and autoimmune diseases?
Right, well...
I'll copy and paste that question to you. Here we go. That just it'll facilitate you answering it easier, I suppose, because there's multiple parts.
Right. Well, essentially, the only thing that I haven't found a health solution to is the problem that I suffer with myself, which is type 1 diabetes. But everything else, be it Lyme, autoimmune, autism, while, of course, one can't bring health back for everybody, for the vast majority, all these things can be overcome. And what I've narrowed it down to, essentially, is about 13 items. There are between 90 and 100 essential nutrients that our bodies can't make from other bits and pieces that you've got to get from outside. You know, there are some essential minerals, essential vitamins, essential amino acids, and essential fats. And you have to have the lot. If you've got one missing, then maybe some part of your body isn't going to work properly. You're going to have Lyme, or you're going to be susceptible to Lyme. It's not that everybody gets
just
it.
Remind me about Lyme. Is that not the one from the tick bite, no?
Yeah, from a tick.
Oh, okay, right. Thank you.
Now, you know, some people get bitten and they get the disease. Other people don't. Some people can walk through a leper colony and they're absolutely fine, and other people get leprosy. Why is that? Is it that one virus is weaker than another or something like that, or one day the wind's blowing in the wrong direction, or what is it? It's got nothing to do with the virus. The thing to be frightened of Ebola-wise is not the virus. The thing to be aware of is that if your body is super strong, you've got all the iodine you need to make healthy cells and healthy hormones and have a healthy thyroid. You've got all the fats you need to build a healthy brain and all the other, you know, every cell has got fat in it. Every cell has cholesterol in it. You know, people don't realize. If you have enough vitamin C so that you have a really healthy skin structure and, you know, you don't risk any scurvy where you crack up, you wouldn't want cracking arteries, for example. If you've got enough magnesium, to make sure that your muscles can relax, that you can relax, if you've got enough of all the minerals, vitamins, essential fats, and amino acids, then your body should be able to work properly again, because we're self-repairing. You imagine you're super well and you cut yourself, cut your finger, say. Probably if you're super well, super healthy, by tomorrow morning it's going to be healed up. If you're not so well, it might take 2 or 3 days. If you're really very unwell, it might just fester. And be pussy for ages, never heal. You know, so we have the capability to heal slow or heal fast. And, you know, if the germ theory were true, and it is a germ theory that Pasteur put out there, and on his deathbed, by the way, Pasteur said he was wrong. Anyway, if the germ theory were true, doctors would be ill all day long because they...
Exactly.
Which is usually small and airless.
Well, I'm going to throw one at you from left field, as they say. I mean, I was a carpenter, a builder, Clive, and like a lot of guys, I mean, no matter how safe I attempted to work, you know, most carpenter chippies will tell you, look, 5-6 times a day, it wouldn't be unusual. You know, a few splinters, a couple of cuts, and you know, the old black nail, usually on the left hand, because that's what the hammer was whacking towards. And I mean, because I used to do a variety of trades, I always used to have, I don't know if you've ever heard of Boss White. It's basically a linseed oil based putty. And if I got a bad cut, I just used to take a lump of linseed, whack it on the cut and wrap it in electrical gaffer tape. And I used to heal incredibly fast.
Well, very interesting. And I'm sure if one looked at an old herbal, it would probably tell you that's exactly what to do. I wonder whether somebody taught you or whether it was your intuition.
No, it was my father and their family. You know, there's a long line of carpenters, but a lot of carpenters used to carry, it's a plumber's product, Boss White.
Right.
They call it. But in fact, it's like a runny version of window putty.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I think, because it was made with boiled linseed oil and, what the heck was the other product in it? It's like a powder of some description. But it was great for bunging up things. You know, so if you got a deep gash, you could it wouldn't sting when you were putting it in either, so it meant you could still work. So you could push it into the wound, around with a bit of gaffer tape, and you were back working again.
Wow, very interesting.
Mm. Now, I don't know if it congealed. There was another product that came out. It came out in Northern Ireland. You couldn't get it in Southern Ireland, called New Skin. It was basically like, it looked like a clear nail polish that guys started to use in the building. And I used to say to them, no, here, don't be using that, because if they flexed their hand, this thing would set hard and crack. It was kind of like, I suppose it was some type of like a super glue type of deal, you know, for builders, particularly were using it if they get a bad slice. And I used to say to them, no, look, come here. Boss White, electrical tape, you know, stretchy electrical tape was the best. And you can keep working, it won't crack and you won't need, you know, and it was fantastic.
Yeah. I'd like to just rewind to the questions that you were mentioning earlier in the chat box.
Okay.
One was about Lyme and the other was about rope worms, and autism and autoimmune disease. Now, there are two products that are really interesting. I mentioned the turpentine earlier, the pure gum spirits.
Uh-huh.
For parasites, again, I would recommend everybody researches that as a possibility. But there are two sources of information on the pure gum spirits. One is on my Health Revolution program with Jennifer Daniels. The other one is on Tony Pantalaresco's site on YouTube. I also interviewed Tony Pantalaresco. You might want to hear that as well. There's also diatomaceous earth. Diatomaceous earth is incredibly inexpensive, and if you had plants in the garden you wanted to protect against slugs or snails, you put a little circle of diatomaceous earth and the slugs and snails won't cross it, and that's because it's incredibly sharp, and it's fine for you to use occasionally, but any parasites you've got living in, you actually hate it because it rips them to shreds, so it's a very cheap way. Other sort of parasite cures would be, there's a herbal mix of clove, black walnut hull, and wormwood, and one can get them as tinctures, or you can get them from herb, as dried herbs, and recipes, and when to take them, how often a day, are on YouTube. So, you know, all one's got to do, really, is go on to Google and put in whatever the problem is with the words natural cure, and you'll find the answers probably on page one of Google. You know, although the internet is being controlled, it's still remarkably, wonderfully open. And, you know, you so many of the clients that I see, I say, have you done that? Have you put, you know, whatever it is, autism and natural cure onto Google? And most of them haven't looked. Autism's the wrong example, but arthritis, for instance, it's surprising how many people actually haven't spent any time at all researching their own problem, whereas if they're going to buy a new sofa or something, or a new washing machine, they might spend ages researching, or a new TV, might spend ages researching which is the best one. If something goes wrong, and the first doctor that says anything, you say, all right, then, go ahead with it.
Is it a case, Clive, that the doctors are too quick to, you know, what they used to call them, sawbones? Okay, we need to slice and dice. Or is it that they just say, no, it's, pop a pill? I mean, is it pop a pill or slice and dice that's the main problem these days?
Well, you know, the Chinese medical system was based on the idea that if everybody was well in the family, the doctor got paid.
Yeah, that's right.
The moment one person wasn't well, all payment to the doctor stopped until he got them well.
Yeah.
That was an incentive to get people well. But the English system, the European system, the Western medical allopathic system is based on how many ill people you've got. You know, a patient cured is a customer lost. And, you know, even if the patient does die, the doctor gets 70 quid or something for signing the piece of paper that says he's dead. You know, it's called a death certificate.
Are you aware also that in Ireland in particular, a staggeringly large amount of them do not take or make the Hippocratic Oath?
Yes, this is true.
So, effectively, you know, the so-called inverted commas power of a doctor, really, idea of an empowered doctor came from the fact that the perception was that they had made that Hippocratic Oath. You know, that was why people would say, oh, don't worry, he's a doctor. Inverted commas, it was understood, well, he's taken an oath to do no harm. Well, now we have doctors who have made no such oath. That's why, I mean, people are wondering, why are they not liable for all the things they're doing? They actually get you to contract into it, and they get you your agreement, and again, along the lines of what I was talking about earlier, they effectively create contracts with you, and they get you to agree either to a quasi-employed or constructive or normal contract to take the medication, etc., etc. And they're released from any wrongdoing or perceived wrongdoing by your actions. I mean, I've often said to people, look, if you have a family doctor on the record, inverted commas, ring him up tomorrow and tell him he's fired. Particularly if you're a part of, you know, or if you're associated and you have these ideas, as Cameron was saying, if you believe a 9/11 was an inside job, 7/7, they will use your family doctor to have you certified, if they so choose, and put inside. And they will place the form in front of your doctor, your family doctor, and if he doesn't sign it, they'll say, well, now, if you don't sign this, we made the offer to you. You're now going to be liable for anything that this guy may do, and we're telling you we think he's a liability. They're just going to say, well, hang on, give me the form back again, and he's just going to sign it. If you fire him, that can't happen. Now, at the meetup today, somebody was talking about in Germany, they have, I can't remember the exact expression, but what they do is, a lot of these people are going in to effectively have their own psychiatric evaluation done, and it's put on the record in a certain manner so that if, for example, you are taken in, you know, interrogated and some judge somewhere decides you need to have a psychiatric evaluation, you can go, hold on, I have this one here, and, you know, it's all good. And it will stand. And now, I don't know about Ireland or England, etc., but well worth looking into. How are we doing time-wise? 20 minutes to go. So, Clive, I mean, I know about other remedies, for example, that, you know, guys on building sites have talked about for, you know, forever, effectively, and nobody outside of the building trades seem to know about them. All trades seem to have their own version of, you know, the trade secret, the trade cure. There's billions of them, isn't there? I had one for splinters, for example. Certain splinters from certain timbers, if you get them in, you know, particularly some of the exotic timbers, you really need to get them out of your body as fast as possible. And, you know, I mean, there was a guy, this was like going way, way back. One of the old guys, again, always watch the old guys on the building site, folks, if you want to learn something. And this guy couldn't get this splinter out, and he got another piece of wood. And he used cascamite, which is a glue made from cow's milk, I believe. And he stabbed this splinter in on top of the other splinter with some of this cascamite glue on it, and bandaged his hand and left it for a while. And he came back, and then he, you know, yanked the two of them out together, because the cascamite apparently only adhered to the timber, so it would adhere to the timber that it was in, the timber on the splinter, not his flesh. It set, and he yanked out the pair of them together on a deep splinter. There's another message came through earlier, Clive. I don't know if you want to read that one out, in relation from JB. Sorry, have I lost you, Clive? Ooh, I think I lost
Sorry.
No, he's back. Sorry about that, Clive. Yeah, but had you ever heard that one, using, you know, effectively using a splinter with cascamite to extract a deep splinter?
I haven't. What I've used is Epsom salts, you know, magnesium sulfate. You just mix it with a little bit of water into a paste and shove it on over the splinter with a, like a plaster or a bandage on top, and the Epsom salts actually draw the splinters out.
I've used Epsom salts for donkey's years. I actually have, I went into, where was it, one of these modern chemists, Boots, I think it was, and I asked the girl, do you have Epsom salts? She said, I do. And she pointed to a little tub on the shelf, and I mean a little tub, I mean, we're talking, you know, 2 inches high and an inch wide, and I said, right, I need a bit more than that. And I think that little itty bitty tub was something like £5. So she said, oh, I think we have bigger ones in the back. And she came back with a 10-liter bucket of the stuff, and she scanned it with the gun at the cash register, and she said, £8. So
yeah.
For a bucket of the stuff was £8. And for a little itty bitty one was like £6.
Fantastic.
Yeah. It's incredible. The other one I was going to ask you about, client, sorry, that one there that I said, the message from JB. Do you want to talk a little about that, frankincense?
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, that's interesting.
No, I know JB very well. Fantastic guy. Wonderful guy. And if I would say to you, if he's typed that, that's 100%. You could take that to the bank, as they say.
Yes. Well, I'm really pleased to hear it. It's some very good news on this guy getting his mother's health back, and I think one of her problems was skin cancer, for example. And there's a lot of misunderstanding about skin cancer. You know, people are led to believe it's the sun that's doing it, when obviously it's burning that does it. My ex got some chip fat splashed around her eyes, and it all went to skin cancer. And, you know, it's burning, not the sun. We need the sun to be well. But there are a number of things that are curing all sorts of issues. One of the ways to get your health back, particularly if you've been unlucky enough to be burnt, are, and JB mentions it, high-grade frankincense essential oil. And it's very important with essential oils to make absolutely sure that they are of a high enough quality that they'd be called therapeutic blend.
And can I ask you, what is frankincense extracted from? I mean, what's it the essential oil of?
It's a tree, and it grows, the most famous place that it grows is Oman. I met this guy who goes every 2 months to Oman looking at all the different grades of frankincense and buying the very best that there is. And his frankincense is just extraordinary. And you can go into a health food store and pick up a bottle of frankincense for £3.50 or something.
Right.
But, you know, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the sort of £50.
I mean, is this the same frankincense as we're told from the biblical story?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And there was a reason why it was so...
I was going to say, that's interesting that it's presented in that story. So for a nursing mother, would frankincense have any implications, or?
Well, frankincense has a vast array of uses. And, not only will it deal with an awful lot of skin issues, but it can deal a number of mental, areas where you want to think more clearly. I haven't got my reference book in front of me to remind me of everything that it does, but you know, at another time maybe, you know, we might want to do an interview just on essential oils and what they can do, because some of them are just so ridiculous. I mean, if you look, for instance, at peppermint, they've done experiments with children and exams and found that if they are smelling the essential oil of peppermint, they do significantly better in exams.
I've heard the same about lavender.
Lavender might make them a little bit sleepy, but I'm sure it probably has the same effect. But yeah, peppermint is the exact frequency of the brain. So let's say if I was driving home and I was getting really tired, if I had a sniff of peppermint oil, or even better, put a drop on my tongue, boy, would I be awake.
Right.
You put some on your tongue, real proper peppermint oil, and it just zings your brain. It's amazing. And, the oils are very interesting. And although one has to spend a bit of money to buy them in the first instance, they last for ages.
Mm.
And, for cuts, for infections.
Well, I remember, I smashed a rear molar and, I never did anything about it, and I left it there for ages. And one night I was on radio, and it caused some severe, let's just say it really captivated my attention for a while, okay? And somebody typed in, oil of cloves, Vin, get it on quick and you'll be grand. And yeah. I'd never used an essential oil before, and I was absolutely stunned at how quick, I mean, it was like that. It was incredible. I was thinking, oil of cloves onto my tooth. I've smashed the tooth here. It's rotten. It's in bits. And I actually still have the tooth. And I've been doing the coconut oil swilling.
All right.
And the tooth. I don't get any pain in my. I used to have terrible pain in my teeth, and I don't anymore.
Well, very good.
I don't have the prettiest smile in the world, but I still have my own smile, and I've no fillings, zero fillings.
Well, you know, people somehow imagine that their teeth aren't alive, but obviously the teeth are just like the cut on your finger that I mentioned. You know, if your teeth are really healthy, even if you've got a cavity, they can heal up. The cavity can heal itself right away if you catch it at the beginning. If you cut your finger, well, what you wouldn't do would be pour hot drinks in there, or Coca-Cola, or hot food. In fact, you probably wouldn't want to rub food in the cut at all if you wanted to get better. So people need to realize that there are ways to rebuild cavities. You know, if you've got a cavity, if it hasn't gone too far, with things like really good butter, preferably, you know, Jersey butter, which is fantastic for rebuilding teeth, avoiding grains, particularly wheat, but avoiding grains, eating really high fat foods like fatty meat, fatty fish, eggs, avocados, coconut oil, cod liver oil. There are a number of ways that you can rebuild teeth. And if you really want to look after your teeth, let's say you've got a cavity and you really want to fix it, then you could be using colloidal silver to kill any infection. You could be using clove oil, diluted, or rather carefully, because it's a very hot oil. You could be taking large doses of vitamin C and vitamin D. There are a number of things that you can do to repair your teeth and make them strong from this point on, because obviously...
I have to say, my results personally, I'm a smoker, I like to drink red wine, and I like to drink coffee. So I have all of those, very effective stains in my teeth, but as I said, once I started using the coconut oil, the clove oil, and I brush my teeth with the coconut oil, with a couple of drops of peppermint oil in it, and then once a week I have another mix with the bicarb of soda and the coconut oil that I use as well. I used to have terrible teeth. I had receding gums. I don't have that anymore, and I don't have any pain in my teeth. Now they're still, I don't have a toothpaste smile, but I have teeth that I can use again.
Well, if you want the toothpaste smile, add some turmeric powder to your medicine. So,
there's a guy who used to be on here, Summa Messe, and he brought me down a tub of turmeric, right? Mm. He neglected to mention this stuff is like tattooing your face if you're not careful. And I had a big yellow Homer Simpson style face for a couple of days.
Ah, I see. Well, so long as you keep it in your mouth and not around your face.
He neglected to mention that.
Oh dear.
I think he thought it was quite amusing. Absolutely. It's incredible.
I gave some to a friend who's a smoker, and he told me that he'd used it twice, and he'd just spent £1,000 with the dentist getting a Hollywood smile, and he said the whiteness that he got just rubbing it twice with 1 pence worth of turmeric was better than £1,000.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't believe the difference. I was literally shocked, and I was disgusted that I didn't do it before. I was going to do it before and after photograph, but at the time I was thinking, wow, my delph is in bits. I'm not going to do it before and after. But I think even from now on, I think I'll start taking photos, because I'm now doing it regularly. I got a decent supply of all these things now. And that's a thing, Clive. Can we talk about maybe daily maintenance? What should a body do for daily maintenance?
Well, when the stresses of life happen daily, try not to let them affect your wonderful day. The only way I get through the day is literally by doing that. I try not to allow anything or anybody affect my wonderful day. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't always work, but I do I keep that in mind.
No, but I mean, for example, should a body, I take well water. I try to eat as best I can. I don't eat junk. I never really eat junk food. But I try to eat what I call plain old fashioned ordinary food, vegetables as much as I can, fruits, etc. I was a wheataholic, as they say, and I've had to cut down on that. I do eat bread still, but I eat whole meal and whole grain and whatnot. And as often as possible, I take everything with the skin on. When it comes to vegetation, I try to eat skin as much as possible, as well as the veg.
So you're not eating many pineapples then?
Actually, I did. I juiced a pineapple with the skin and all, and I drank it. Let's just say, I wouldn't recommend that, folks. That was a very interesting experience. It felt like I was being stung from the inside out.
I mean, it's never a good idea, that kind of thing, because remember that the reason that all the plants have skins is to deliberately repel viruses, fungus, bacteria, whatever it is that might try to get through them. So the outsides sometimes can be quite toxic.
Well, when it comes to pineapples, apparently, someone else was telling me that the best part of the pineapple you can eat is actually the hard core in the middle.
Uh-huh.
What was it? Vitamin K, I think he said.
Oh, right. That's interesting. Vitamin K is really important.
Yeah. You know the hard center? It's not particularly pleasant. It's not unpleasant. I mean, it has a pineapple-y smell and flavor, but it's not pleasant. You're chewing this for 20 minutes, folks.
To answer your earlier question, the the essentials that we all need that you just have to get by food or supplementation, I've basically put them all into a package, and I sell them on my website as the essentials pack. And there are 13 items, one of them being coconut oil. I mean, you don't have to use coconut oil as the absolute essential, but it's just a way of saying, look, one way or another, you need the essential fats. So I've put together, iodine, magnesium chloride as a spray that you just spray your magnesium on the body and rub it in. It's incredibly good for relieving pain of arthritis and so on. Fulvic minerals, the trace elements, a multi-mineral, multivitamin, digestive enzymes, because as you get older, you don't digest the food. Even if you're eating good food, you're not able to digest it so well. So digestive enzymes make sure, hopefully, that you're actually being able to assimilate it. Then probiotics, because for the people who have had chlorinated water or antibiotics or drugs from the doctor, they want to try and rebuild their bacteria as best they can. Better than probiotics would be to ferment food like our ancestors did, but a lot of people don't do that. Fermenting your own food would be a lot cheaper than probiotics. Anyway, essentially, I've put together these 13 things, also colloidal silver, so if you get an infection, you've got something to do. It's not the cheapest package in the world, but the most remarkable number of people get better.
Well, look, you go to a doctor, folks, allopathic medicine. It's astounding the prices they're charging. I'm hoping that when Clive comes on board here and he's broadcasting with us, that people will support him and, purchase directly from Clive's website. I'm so happy to promote everything you're talking about here, Clive, and I will do my damnedest to see that people do obtain not just the products, but the knowledge. And, the most important thing we can do is pass on the knowledge, folks. Pass it on. Spread it around. Tell people. Tell people about Clive DeCarlo, his website, his products. Use them. Report back to Clive. Tell him. I mean, you're good with that, Clive, right? People coming back to you and saying, yeah, Clive, I got this, this, and this. I was suffering from this, this, and this. And now I have, this is gone, that's gone. I have a little bit of this. Can we improve that or whatever? I mean, I'm sure, feedback is very important to you.
It's terribly important. And it's very heartening as well. Absolutely. And, one of the other things is that if you're lucky enough to have some elderly relatives alive or any relatives, it's a really good idea to say, look, do you remember when you were young or whatever, any remedies from way back when? Do you remember what your grandmother used? And so on. And whatever information they do still remember, because most children particularly take in and remember things that worked. So you may find your mum or whoever you've got, maybe a really good source of information. If you've got nobody, find some random old people and ask them what they remember. What were the natural cures that you can remember?
Absolutely. Clive, what's your website?
Well, I've got several. The supplements website is ancientpurity.com. Then I do workshops, and if you want to come to one of the workshops, you want to go on to healthgenius.uk. And it was only afterwards that I realized that they might think that's me that's trying to be a health genius. The idea is that you come on the course and you become a health genius. Remember, doctors in their studies, they don't study health. It's not a subject they study. So if you come and do a couple of days workshops with us, you're going to know more about health than your doctor in one sense.
Fantastic. Well, we've come to the end, Clive. Again, as always, it went by like click of the fingers and it's gone. I admire you so much. I think you're just a wonderful, wonderful man. A decent human being, and we need more like you.
Well, likewise, there are not that many people who've been run radio stations, so well done.
Well, thank you. And I'm going to play this one for you. I don't know if you're a fan of Sam and Dave, Clive, but this one I think is appropriate for you, and I'm going to play it for you. It's called Soul Man. And I'll say, Ihoa agus Kulasov. You've been listening to peoplesinternetradio.com. Don't forget, oh, by the way, folks, the schedule has been updated. We've added more people in For example, you'll see on Thursday nights there we have Lou, Collins and Danielle, the No Holds Barred show is added in. On Monday, Dark Side of the Room is added in. On Tuesday, Back to Health. Actually, I'd love to get you hooked up, Clive, with Fiona, who does the Back to Health broadcast on Tuesdays, first Tuesday of the month.
Is that Fiona Burns?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know Fiona.
Excellent, excellent. Well, maybe you might consider doing an interview with Fiona as an introductory thing. Anyway, I don't want to put you on the spot. So look, I'm going to say goodnight, folks.
Yeah, get her to invite me on her show.
I will do. Excellent. Actually, the first Tuesday month's coming up very soon. Thank you again, Clive. Good night. God bless you.
Thank you, Ben.
A pleasure, as always. Good night, folks. Stay tuned. Up next, of course, it's the one and only Gillian Trebilcock. Good night. God bless.